is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Yay, we are live April 11th, 2017. It is 10 a.m. Pacific, 11 Mountain Time, I do believe, and that's the time we had pegged away for a very special hour on News for the Soul, especially in times that we are in right now. We've talked to him many times over the years, and this, I believe, is going to be one of the most important chats because of what's going on in our world today. Greg Braden, New York Times best-selling author, is internationally known as a pioneer in bridging science and spirit, which is one of the favorite places we like to hang out. Following a successful career as a computer geologist in the 1970s, he worked as a senior liaison with the U.S. Air Force Space Command during the Cold War years in the 80s. In the 90s, he became started exploring the spirituality side as well, and the two come together in a very most interesting way. He explored high mountain villages, remote monasteries, and forgotten texts, and started connecting the dots, and that's where it gets really exciting. Today we're going to talk about his latest book as well, Resilience of the Heart. I understand it's the revised edition of The Turning Point, so we're going to find out all about that and find out what I'm most excited about, checking in and tuning in with Greg's exciting perspective, conscious perspective on what the heck is going on in our world of extremes right now. Greg Braden, welcome back to News for the Soul.
Hey, Nicole, it's so good to hear your voice. I'm absolutely thrilled to be with you today and thrilled to be with our audience. Thank you for inviting me back. We've done this a number of times, and when I saw the list came into my office of my media interviews that I was going to have this week, I saw your name, a big smile on my face, because we always have a really great program, and I appreciate you very much. Thank you.
Right back at you. We are very much appreciating the piece that you bring to the big picture, and holy moly. I don't even know where to start today. It's been a few years since we've talked, but
Can I get us started today?
Yeah.
I'm going to just share with our listeners, I had a really interesting interview recently, another radio station, and the first thing the interviewer said to me, he didn't say, welcome to the show, how are you, anything like that. He said, Greg, why can't you stick with one topic like everybody else? He said, you are all over the map. He said, are you talking about science, spirituality, about DNA, about ancient history, about earth magnetics, about climate change? He goes, what are you talking about? And I said, you know, every one of those things that you've just mentioned is a facet of the human experience. And in a very real sense, I said, I am talking about one thing, one topic. It just happens to be a really big topic, and it's about us and our relationship to ourselves and to the world and to the past and one another and to the future. And then he said, well, let's take a station break. And then we came back and did the rest of the interview. So my work, it does touch on many facets of our experience, because we don't live in a vacuum. That's the world that we live in. And that's one of the reasons I love working with you, Nicole, because you are doing such a beautiful job of taking a message that for some people is a new way and a very different way of thinking, and sharing this in a responsible way across the airwaves. And I appreciate that. I just appreciate it tremendously.
Well, we really value your work and your piece, and I'm extremely interested to get your overall perspective. That's where I'd like to start, is, the world's very different than it was when we last talked. We were kind of on this exciting ascension of connection, and, you were showing videos of tumors disappearing in 60 seconds. We're all very happy and excited and woo. And we thought we'd be in a different place by now. It's got this overall view of things kind of going off the rails in the mainstream, and I thought we were further ahead, evolved consciously, and, perspective on where we are in the world with in the spirit and consciousness connections. How would you sum it up in that view?
Yeah, I was just reading a history summary of the last 200 years of our experience, and what many historians now are suggesting, they embrace that the 20th century, they're saying, was a century of what they're calling a century of discovery. Okay, so the big discoveries of physics, classical physics, quantum physics, subatomic particles, DNA, The Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi Library, the oldest records of the New Testament, the Nag Hammadi, and space exploration. It was a century of exploration, and it revealed many things to us. And the 21st century, they say, where we are right now, is we are on a very steep learning curve of discovering where those discoveries fit in our lives. How do we apply what we now know to be true in our everyday lives? And I think the world is reflecting that. Right now, Nicole, I trust in the process. The world is a different place than I expected that we would be in, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the indigenous people that I've talked to and worked with, many of the ancient texts, they say within the first 25 years of this new century, they said we won't even recognize our lives and our world anymore. And I think, we're seeing that happen. So we're learning about ourselves and our relationship to the world based upon new discoveries. And this is what I'm writing about. The new book, the newest book that is on the market right now that you have access to is called Resilience from the Heart. There's actually another book that will be released October of this year called, the title is Human by Design. And both of these books are based upon peer-reviewed science. So it's rock-solid science, not necessarily my opinion or my perspective or my hypotheses or my theories, but this is the new science, Nicole, that is changing the way we think about ourselves and our relationship to the world on the one hand. And on the other hand, there is not only a reluctance, but there is a resistance to sharing a lot of this new information in the mainstream because it overturns 150 years of scientific thinking and the story that we tell ourselves. We are steeped in this scientific story that's based upon separation, scarcity, competition, and conflict. And the new discoveries are telling us that we live in a world of cooperation. Nature is based upon cooperation, not competition, and that we are deeply connected to ourselves and one another. And the science is showing us just how deep these connections go. So that is the theme for both of the new books, and the one that you just mentioned, Resilience from the Heart, is just that. It is about the new discoveries of specialized cells in the human heart that allow us a direct access to our bodies in ways that we've never thought possible in the past. We thought only mystics and yogis and special adepts could do something like this, and now it's becoming available to everyday people. So that's a long answer to a short question. I trust in the process in the world, and what I think we're seeing is an unfolding of understandings of what is sustainable or what's not, what works, what doesn't. And what we're finding is a lot of the way we've been taught to think is no longer sustainable. And so we're the generation that's bridging these new discoveries and learning to apply them in our world. And I can't think of a more exciting time to be alive. I'm sure many of your other speakers are probably saying something very similar. So again, that's a long answer to a short question, and I'll follow your lead, and we can go anywhere we want to go from there.
It is a very exciting time for sure. And I think you nailed it right in the first half of your first sentence in response was that, before we were learning about these things, now it's essentially, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but basically we have to start doing what we've learned.
Yeah.
Being it.
Well, that's the thing. What's happening is in the mid-1800s, when I began talking about the discoveries of Charles Darwin and, many of the physicists that were making discoveries in the late 1800s, people say to me, Greg, we're in the 21st century. What difference could those things possibly make? And it's a really good question, and the answer surprises a lot of people. Yes, we are in the early 21st century, a sophisticated, highly technological world, and the society that we find ourselves in and the way we have been conditioned to think about jobs, about industry, about our relationship to the earth, about personal relationships, the economy, corporations, all of those things, those ideas, those foundations were created in the mid to late 1800s. So we are steeped in a story based upon the science of the late 1800s, and now the new science is overturning many of those beliefs. So knowing that we live in a world of cooperation, for example, rather than competition, that nature is actually based in cooperation, our economic systems were based upon competition and conflict based on the science of the 1800s, and that's why the economies of the world are in chaos right now. We're seeing the Brexit in the Middle East. We're seeing the European Union face a possible breakdown. We're looking looking at the kind of debt. Here's a question, Nicole. This is fascinating. We've all seen nations in debt in the past, and it's common for another nation or a group of nations to bail them out. What happens when the debt of the entire planet is greater than what the entire planet is producing? When the GDP of the entire planet is less than the debt that we've accumulated, who bails out an entire planet? And I don't know the answer to that. We're about to find out, because that's where we are right now. The industrialized nations have accrued so much debt that can never be paid back. That affects everything from the way that we save for retirement, the way we save for our kids' education, our health care, all of those things. So they're breaking down because they are based on principles that are simply not true. We don't live in a world of competition and conflict. We see those things. I mean, we have to be real, though we definitely witness competition and conflict in the world. And what the scientists now are telling us is the more of that competition and conflict that we see in the world, the further we have strayed from the natural laws, and the more difficult it is for us to find our balance. So for me personally, I'm a scientist. I was trained as an earth scientist, a geologist. And I know some of your other guests and dear friends of mine, Dr. Bruce Lipton, for example, and Dr. Joe Dispenza, we all look to nature for the model of helping us to understand our relationship to ourselves and to the world, and how to build a healthy family and a healthy community and healthy societies. So if we look to nature, nature is showing us a very different model than what we have in place right now, and we're seeing, I think, the world is going through the throes of the changes to try to get back to more of those natural states of balance. And that's what the book Resilience from the Heart is all about, because one of the discoveries, and we mentioned this briefly in another interview, one of the discoveries that has just rocked the world of the medical world, the world of biology, is the discovery of 40,000 specialized cells in the human heart that were simply not recognized in the capacity that they are right now. They are called sensory neurites. And that's a technical term. They're essentially brain-like cells, but they're not in the brain. They're in the heart. So these are the kind of cells you would expect to see in the cranial brain, but they're in the heart. And the reason this is important is because these cells think independently of the cells in our brain. They feel independently of the cells in our brain, and they remember independently of the cells in our brain. So every experience we've had in our lives, essentially it's recorded in two places. It's recorded in our brain and the way our brain interprets it, and we know about that. It's recorded in our heart and the way our heart interprets these experiences through these 40,000 cells that have created a neural network that is literally, it's called the little brain in the heart, is the term that's being used now. So now that we know these cells exist, as we're learning to access them, they open the door to extraordinary abilities that I personally believe are actually ordinary abilities that we've either lost or forgotten. And when we can embrace these abilities in our lives, it helps us to embrace change in the world in a healthy way. So if we ever needed a time, or if we never needed some help in embracing the tremendous change happening in the world, now I think is the time to do that, because we are undergoing such a radical shift in the world that we've known in the past. So this is the theme. The new book, in the very first chapter, you asked about the two books. There was a book that was released, I think it was 2015 or 2014. It was called The Turning Point, and it was a good book. It put many of the personal applications and the direct experience and the exercises that help people in their lives, they were in the back of the book. And one of the things that I've learned, Nicole, I'm a student of learning to listen. I'm still learning, and I work very diligently in listening to my audience and to our global audience. And what people all over the world said, they said, we want to get to that stuff faster. We want to get to the stuff that's going to help us in our everyday lives, direct experience, techniques, tools, applications. So I moved all of that to the front, and I added the new material and the new discoveries that simply were not available when I had written the book 2 years previous. So it's new material covering these 40,000 neurites, how we access them, and what it means in a changing world. And that is what sets those two books apart from one another. Does that make sense if I say it that way?
It's so interesting. I decades ago, I interviewed Joseph Chilton Pierce, you know, cracking the cosmic egg, and he was saying all along, you know, for years and years and years, that the real brain power was in the heart, and we've heard so many people refer to that. So when was this recent study you're referring to, when was that published?
Well, first, I've had the honor of knowing, touring, and presenting with Joseph Chilton Pierce, and he mm-hmm. was working very closely with the Institute of Heart Math,
yes.
H-E-A-R-T, capital M-A-T-H, all one word. This is the pioneering research organization based in Northern California that explores the power of the human heart in unconventional ways, in ways that typically aren't done in the universities and in the medical schools, but based in science, in peer-reviewed science. So I had the opportunity of touring with Joseph Chilton Pierce during the years when a lot of this information is being developed. The discovery was made in 1991. It wasn't published until 1994. And even though, this is fascinating for me, even though it was published in 94 and it is now documented, it's peer-reviewed science is documented, it is still not being taught in major medical institutions. And I just came last weekend. I just came from a large conference, and it's very common for us to have medical professionals and healing professionals and scientists and engineers in the audience, along with, you know, with everyone else, the spiritual seekers. They all come together because this material touches on so many different facets of our experience. And I had medical students in the audience, and they were saying, why don't we know about this? Why isn't this being taught in medical school? And I said, you know, I can't answer that question. But you're here now, and now you know about it. So, but it changes. It changes everything. When we talk about this little brain in the heart, and people say, well, you know, is it really a brain? It is it's a collection of cells that are concentrated into a network, a neural network, smaller but very similar to what we see in the brain. And we've learned to use the brain independently. We know that. Now we know that we can use the heart independently. And we also know now that we can harmonize, we can literally tune the heart and the brain together. So two separate organs, but it is one very potent neural network to give us access to extraordinary experiences like deep intuition on demand when we choose to have it rather than spontaneously, you know, when it just happens to occur. It gives us direct access to the subconscious. It's a hotline to the subconscious without hypnosis and without, you know, listening to a special tape. You can do all those things, but sometimes they're not available. So direct access to the subconscious, and this is important for people who are using affirmations, because an affirmation of healing or health or relationship or career success or self-esteem or abundance or any of those kinds of things, they can only be effective when we are communicating with the subconscious. And if we simply say these things in our mind, but we're not accessing our subconscious, they may not have the effect that we hope that they have. So this harmonizing of the heart and the brain is a hotline into the subconscious to make those kinds of things more effective. Harmonizing the heart and the brain is a trigger for a extra powerful, super immune response. And I can speak for my colleagues, my dear spiritual brothers and friends that I've toured with, such as Bruce Lipton and Joe Dispenza. We use these tools, or we couldn't tour the world with the kinds of schedules we have if we didn't have really powerful immune systems and the ability to regulate these things. So we apply these in our own lives. It's also a trigger for the anti-aging hormones that every one of us has in our bodies. It's also a trigger for reducing stress and creating more resilience in our lives in time of change. So all of a sudden, knowing that we have access to these cells and that we can harmonize our heart and our brain and our brain together so they can work together, the act of doing this, that single act, opens the door to this vast array of applications, whether it's intuition on demand or, you know, the 1,300 biochemical reactions, positive biochemical reactions, and we can do this. This is what makes us so very powerful. We now know that we are the only species known so far that can trigger these and initiate these relationships on demand. Other forms of life may be able to do it naturally, but we can consciously say in this moment in time, I choose to initiate a state of deep intuition. And that covers everything from precognition, you know, knowing about something before it's going to happen, to being able to communicate with other forms of life, with other mammals. A lot of research is being done with using the heart to communicate with other forms of life. It just goes on and on. So I'm sharing, we're just scratching the tip of the iceberg here. This opens mm-hmm. an entire new door of possibilities for these experiences that help us in everyday life that we in the past believed were relegated only to mystics and yogis, you know, living isolated lives in a mountaintop half a world away. We can do this stuff in our living room. And the science now is telling us how it works. And our most cherished and ancient spiritual traditions are telling us how to apply these things in our lives. This is where these two come together in a really beautiful way.
How do we access and utilize these brain cells in the heart? And have you actually engaged in any of these experiments with anyone around that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'll say the instructions I give, they're very detailed instructions that are in the book Resilience from the Heart. The science has been validated. A lot of the science comes from the Institute of Heart Math and the work they've done over the last 20, I'm sure it's more than 20 years now, that they have perfected in the laboratory under laboratory conditions. My experience with indigenous people is that they have initiated techniques that parallel what the science is now developing. And I think if something is true, I think you're going to see it show up in a lot of different ways. So the fact that science is now catching up, science is only about 300 years old. These indigenous traditions, spiritual traditions, many of them are 5,000 years old. So science is catching up with what our ancestors and what many indigenous traditions have always told us. So since 1986, I've had the opportunity to be with our indigenous family in many different settings, and the monks and nuns and the abbots and the monasteries in Tibet and Nepal and India and through the Andes Mountains of Bolivia and Peru and the monasteries in Egypt and all through the American Desert Southwest and the Yucatan and Mexico and more. And as different as they are from one another, Nicole, what's so fascinating is that there are common themes that flow through every one of these traditions, even though they're spread through different times, different environments, different parts of the world. And when I'm working with the healers and the curanderos and the shamans in these traditions, one of the first things they do before they begin whatever their practice is they begin to access their heart. And that's precisely where the science is leading right now. So the techniques are techniques of focus, of breathing, physically being able to draw the attention from our mind into our heart. This is, I think, probably one of the hardest things for people in the West to do. If I ask someone in a Western environment, in a corporate environment, and if I ask them, if I invite them to shift their awareness from their mind into their heart, they'll say, okay, I'm in my heart now, what's next? And I'll say, well, you know, are you really in your heart? And they say, you know, well, how do you know? And this is where these techniques from the indigenous people really come in handy. One, for example, and I'll just share one of the techniques that they share, is if we can gently touch our heart center, the center of our chest, right there on the sternum, gently touch that in a way that's comfortable for us. Some people use their middle finger and their ring finger, and they just simply touch their right on the bone right there, right over the heart. I'm doing it right now as if you could see me, and here we are on the radio, so we're not. But some people in some traditions, in the Middle East, for example, they use an entire open palm, and they place that palm over the center of their chest, over their hearts. And they do the same thing in the Yucatan in southern Mexico. They do the same thing. The point here is that the Buddhists will make the prayer mudra that we're all familiar with, and then they hold that prayer mudra with their thumbs right against the center of their chest. And this is what all of these traditions are doing, is they are physically touching their heart center, and here is the reason why that's important.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights. Life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Our awareness, our conscious awareness, will always go to the place in our body where we feel a physical sensation. So when we physically touch our heart center in one of these ways, our awareness automatically goes to the place where that sensation is, and that is one of the techniques that the indigenous people use to move their awareness from their thinking mind into their feeling heart. So I'm just using that as an example. And then the breathing techniques that come after that are now validated. We have equipment, technology that we can hook people up to specialized pieces of software and be able to actually see the effect in their bodies that are occurring from making these connections. So we can talk more about that if you'd like to. I don't know how far you want to go with all of this.
Down the rabbit hole. Yeah, absolutely. This is news to us all. I'll just remind people listening, if you missed it, you mentioned heart math. I talked to Howard Martin, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, and that's in the archives at newsforthesoul.com. And it's funny, you know, when you hear things in threes, this independently, this general topic about the power, true power of the heart has come up three times independently in three different ways for me this week. So I know this is important, and ultimately tying it back into current world events would be awesome. But tell us what's next.
What's next where?
At where you wanted to go.
Oh, well, you just mentioned Howard Martin. Howard is I met Howard because of HeartMath in the early 1990s, and I trained directly with Howard Martin, who is one of the founders of the Institute of HeartMath. Mm-hmm. And I've had the opportunity to tour the world. We have been on stages everywhere, and now I can call him a dear friend as well. So many of the things that I am saying here from my perspective, Howard and the Institute of HeartMath have given me permission as an independent author to share my experience and my perspective, integrating their work at the same time. So where I've had more experience with indigenous people and how indigenous people throughout the different traditions, how they have learned to apply this in our lives, Howard and the research team, the rock solid science behind this stuff, from their institute in Northern California, they come at it from a little bit different perspective when they're training, you know, in a corporate environment or with the U.S. military or something like that. But the bottom line for both is that we're getting people into their hearts. And that means different things to different people, Nicole. We were conditioned, if we were educated in the West, and I'm assuming most of our listeners may not be in North America but have a Western education, we've been taught that the brain is the master organ of the body. And we all know the brain is important, of course. It regulates hormones. It regulates, you know, the temperature in our body and a lot of the rhythms and the cycles and the functions within our bodies. But what we now know is the brain receives the instructions that tell it what to do. Many of those instructions come directly from the heart. Every moment of every day, there is this conversation between our heart and our brain. It's happening right now for everyone listening. There's a conversation. I'll just speak directly to our listeners. Listeners, there's a conversation happening right now between your heart and your brain. Your heart is having a big conversation with your brain through the vagus nerve. It's sending a lot of information through this thick nerve bundle into your brain. Your brain speaks to the heart less. It's not as big of a conversation, and it's coming primarily through the spinal column, down through the back of the brain and then down through the nerves in the spinal cord. So we're always having this conversation. The question is, do we know what we're saying? Do we know what it is that our heart is saying to our brain? And that is the core of these new discoveries and the ancient traditions. And it's by learning to focus in our heart, to breathe specific ways, and to feel very specific kinds of feelings that we set up a dialogue. And the dialogue can be measured electrically. It's a very low frequency, 0.1 hertz, not even one, 0.1 hertz is the frequency that's optimum between the heart and the brain. So when we can focus on our hearts, breathe a little slower than usual, signaling safety to our bodies by breathing a little bit slower than usual, and we can begin feeling positive, what I would call, I don't like to judge feelings, but it's what we call positive feelings, such as gratitude, appreciation, care, compassion. Those are four big ones that the scientists have found work for most people almost 100% of the time. So if you can choose one of those, gratitude, appreciation, care, or compassion, this combination of events, the breathing, the focus, and the feeling, and this is key, when we can feel one or some combination of those four feelings, our body interprets that as this electrical signal from the heart to the brain, and the optimum signal is 0.1 hertz, and when we can establish 0.1 hertz, we can feel the feelings of 0.1 hertz between our heart and our brain, we are said to be in high heart-brain coherence. And that heart-brain coherence is the key to everything that we're talking about here. So in the new book that you mentioned, Resilience from the Heart, first chapter we talk about the new discovery, the cells, 40,000 specialized cells, and then throughout the book, what this means and how we apply it in our lives through various exercises. So that's the essence of what that book is all about.
So are feelings the key, the doorway?
You know, it's interesting. They are not exclusively the key. They are an important component that's been discounted in our culture. For most, most people, we have feelings and emotions and experiences, and we've been conditioned to discount them to a large extent until recently. People in their 50s and 60s right now remember when we were taught that, you know, your feelings aren't, you know, they're not really real. I mean, it's just a feeling is what they used to tell us. You know, it was discounted. Now we know that the feeling is a powerful component in these indigenous traditions. And interestingly, Nicole, the very texts of our most cherished spiritual traditions, the Western Bible, for example, and some of the Eastern traditions, when they were edited and there were pieces that were removed or condensed, what was taken out was the information that tells us the power of human emotion. So, for example, in the Christian Bible, the New Testament, the New Testament, and this isn't about religion, this is about instructions. This is about the masters of the past informing their students of the deep relationship that their students had within themselves and with the world around them. And those were based upon spiritual principles. The religions came along later and wrapped the rules and the dogma around those fundamental spiritual principles for control. But before the religions ever existed, those principles were already there, and so that's why I'm mentioning this. So, for example, New Testament, we know at least 43 books were removed in the 4th century by the Emperor Constantine. And what we see today is the reduced, rearranged, condensed version. It's good, but it isn't complete. And we know that because the Nag Hammadi Library, discovered in the mid-1940s, revealed for the first time the original, all the text in their original form. And among those was a book called The Gospel of Thomas. So the Gospel of Thomas contains very specific instructions for the kinds of things that we're talking about that were simply removed from the biblical canon, from the modern Bible in the 4th century, telling us about the power of human emotion and how to use that emotion for healing in our lives. So that's one example of where we've known this in the past, and then for a number of reasons, that knowledge was taken from one of our most cherished spiritual traditions, and now it's being reintroduced from the language of science. So the power of human emotion is what establishes that 0.1 hertz relationship between the heart and the brain. You can be in your heart and not have the heart-brain relationship, and that is another technique. Sometimes we don't need that full heart-brain relationship. Sometimes we can simply focus in our hearts through touching our heart center, the way that I mentioned, and through breathing techniques that slow our breathing so that we know that we're in a place that's safe. And there are sometimes, for certain kinds of intuition, the technique stops there. That's all you need. And if you want to go deeper and initiate some of the healing techniques and things like that, then you can establish that heart-brain coherence. Also, it has been found to be very effective. I just want to ask, I'm assuming you've had Joe Dispenza on your program. Have you had Joe on recently?
Yes, not recently. I haven't talked to him in a few years, but yes, he's been on as well.
Okay, well, one of the things, and the reason I asked, Dr. Joe Dispenza is a neuroscientist, talks about neuroplasticity and the way the brain can change. Another one of the new discoveries, Nicole, I mean, this stuff, it just goes on and on, because the science is moving so fast right now. But one of the discoveries is the existence of a brain state above the brain states that we've typically seen in our high school and college biology books with the alpha and the beta states. Now we have a gamma state. And the gamma state is a very, very fast brainwave. It is associated with super learning. So, for example, and total recall. So if people have seen movies like, if you've ever seen Jason Bourne, Matt Damon and all of the Jason Bourne movies, where he does these amazing, he could walk into a room, he looks at the room once, he leaves, and he has total recall of everything in the room. Those techniques are actually being taught today, and they're using what we're talking about now, this heart-brain connection, for not only to take in tremendous amounts of information, but to be able to access, to recall the information that we have. Super learning is what it's called. So in a gamma state, that is achieved through this heart-brain connection. We are not only super learning, but it also helps people who are dealing with depression. It moves them out of the state of depression by being in the gamma state. So there are many benefits, health benefits, even if people aren't into what we would call the spiritual aspect, or they're not into the intuition or subconscious or any of those things. Simply harmonizing the heart and the brain is a really healthy thing to do. And it's something that can be done before we do the other things, the other practices that we have. So if we have a yoga practice, for example, yoga goes much better when our heart-brain is harmonized and in coherence. If we have a martial arts practice, we're much more effective when our heart and brain is in coherence. So what I like to say is everything goes better with coherence.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul Highlights. Life-changing spotlight she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
So it's not in place of. We become coherent and then go about doing the practices that are important to us. And these techniques, Howard may have mentioned this, they're actually being used in the U.S. military, all four branches of the U.S. military, for our amazing men and women who are serving our country right now in ways that we just don't get to hear about. They're doing much more than working on the battlefield. So much is going on, rebuilding infrastructure and education and medical and all kinds of things. But before they're deployed, many of them are learning about heart-brain harmony so that they are focused when they're in their deployment. And the flip side that I think is really exciting is once your nervous system is wired for battlefield conditions or for survival, when you're deployed halfway around the world in Iraq or Afghanistan or somewhere like that, it doesn't turn off the moment you get on the plane to come home. And the very sad statistics that that we're seeing about U.S. men and women, service men and women coming home, and high rates of suicide, it's very sad to talk about, high rates of divorce, things like that, because they're having problems reintegrating. How do you make that shift from being in the battlefield to walking down the streets of, San Francisco or Chicago or Albuquerque, New Mexico, or, wherever? And these techniques are actually being used to help them reintegrate and reset. The term is to reset their nervous systems. Also being used by first responders, EMTs, police, fire, first responders right after 9/11, they started using the technique. So I'm just saying this so that our listeners can know this is more than simply a spiritual practice. It is the doorway to the spiritual practices that I've experienced personally through my indigenous experiences or my experiences with indigenous people. But it is also physiologically, it's a really healthy thing to do. And it opens the door to triggering healthy states within us. As I mentioned, over 1,300 biochemical reactions, positive biochemical reactions, just from doing this one technique. That, again, was a long answer to a short question, but I just wanted people to know that the many applications for something like this.
Mm-hmm. And, intellectually, it makes sense, and based on the conversations we've had over the decades of, the connections with the heart and the power of that in bypassing the straight conscious mind, it all makes sense, right? So how do we apply this, or can we apply this, to manifesting a more positive outlook path for the collective in the world right now?
Well, this is it's a really good question, Nicole, and this is another facet of the studies that are being done, pioneered by the Institute of HeartMath. And as a former geologist, I'm not a practicing geologist now, but I am an earth scientist. So I find this, what I'm about to share, especially fascinating. We've all heard of the magnetic field of the earth, and the magnetic field, a lot of people don't know, is that it influences every form of life. I mean, every blade of grass, every dog, every cat, every hamster, every goldfish, every CEO of every corporation, every leader of every nation, there is no them and us when it comes to the magnetic field of the earth. There is only a we. We are all deeply influenced by this field. And here's the reason that I'm saying this and why it's important, is because the science is showing very clearly that when the magnetic field of the earth is strong, it influences us in a positive way. We become less aggressive, more cooperative, more willing to work together, better listeners. And when the magnetic fields are weak, just the opposite happens. We become more aggressive, less willing to work together. And unfortunately, we discovered this through 9/11. 9/11 was the first time that scientists discovered how deep our relationship to the Earth really goes. Now, maybe to our listeners, we say, you know, this is, you know, no big news to us. We've always known this. That's to the listeners of this program. But scientists have been trained to think of humans as separate from one another, separate from the Earth. And they've been trained to believe that we have very little influence over our own bodies and over what happens in the world. And 9/11 taught scientists that that's not true, and here is what happened. The magnetic fields that I just described, they're so important that we have satellites every 30 minutes, or maybe even more frequently, but every 30 minutes they send data back to the Earth to tell scientists how strong those fields are and what's happening. They fluctuate on a daily basis. There are rhythms. They ebb and they flow. It looks like a big sine wave. Every 24 hours, the magnetic fields of the Earth ebb and they flow, and they ebb and they flow. Scientists knew that. But what happened was there was one day when the magnetic data from the Earth, there was this huge spike. It was higher than what they would traditionally see. And they weren't used to seeing that. And they said, well, you know, what on Earth? I mean, literally, what on Earth is happening to make these magnetic fields so strong? And they looked at the date where that spike occurred, and it was 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, September 11th, 2001. It was 15 minutes after the first planes hit the first tower of the World Trade Center. So the scientists believe it took about 15 minutes for those horrific images that we all remember, those of us that were living men. They believe it took about 15 minutes for those images to circulate the globe and for people to respond emotionally to what they were seeing. And for most people, that response, it was a heart-based response. Now, they were different. Some of it was fear. Some of it was sadness. Some of it was shock. But everyone, it was a heart-based experience. The strongest magnetic field generated in the human body is generated by the human heart. And some people are surprised by that because they think it's the brain. The brain has a magnetic and electrical field, but it's weak compared to the human heart. The heart has the strongest electrical and the strongest magnetic field in the human body. So 9/11, what happened was hundreds of millions of people simultaneously were witnessing the horrors of New York City in 9/11, and hundreds of millions of hearts were generating increased magnetic response to what they were seeing that actually influenced the magnetic fields of planet Earth. And this is what was showing up on the satellite data. We spiked the magnetic field of our planet in response to what we saw, and here's why that's important. If you and your listeners can remember it, at least for a few days after 9/11, we were so close as a global family. I mean, not only in America, I was in Australia when the whole thing happened. I couldn't even come home for a few days. So I know that it wasn't only in America, but we were close as a family. People in big cities, they looked at each other in the eyes, and they spoke to one another, and there were hugs that were happening. And there was this sense of unity. And scientists attribute that to the high magnetic fields of the planet that resulted from our seeing what had happened. So the question became immediately, can we create that kind of an experience without the tragedy? Can we consciously raise that magnetic field of the planet without having a tragedy that we react to? Can we do it because we choose to? And the answer is yes. And this became the foundation of a project that is spearheaded by the Institute of Heart Math and for Transparency. I want our listeners to know I'm on the steering committee and a spokesperson for this project that is called the GCI, the Global Coherence Initiative. So the personal coherence we just talked about, personal coherence is good for us individually. Global coherence is good for the planet. And what has happened, I'll just make a long story very brief because I know we're coming up on the end of our hour here. Satellites to detect these fields are very expensive. So the scientists, the Institute of Heart Math, worked on ground-based sensors and created a network of these sensors in different nations that all feed back to one computer in Northern California, and they measure the planet's response. In our interaction with the planet, they measure these magnetic fields every day. And if people want to see these, you can actually see them real time. You can see them about, I think they post them usually at midnight after the data has been analyzed every day, at www.heartmath, H-E-A-R-T-M-A-T-H, all one word, .org, and then go to GCI, Global Coherence Initiative. Doesn't cost you anything. You can see the live data. You can see the science. You can read about the sensors. So we now have a way, a feedback mechanism, so we can see what's happening with the fields of the Earth. That's part one. Part two is training people to create this heart-brain coherence so that throughout every day across this planet, there are people that are literally feeding the field in a positive way. So we're all feeding it every day. We're all having feelings. The question is, what are we feeding the field every day? And it's by learning these various techniques of heart-brain coherence that we're actually contributing not only to our own health, but contributing to the field that influences our cooperation or lack of cooperation on the planet. So it is, there are two things happening here. We've got personal and we've got global healing that is occurring from embracing this relationship that was known by our ancestors in ancient traditions and is now being validated and reconfirmed and expanded through the best science of the modern world. And it all happens within the context of a world that we're living a time of extremes. The world is changing faster than we've been prepared to accept, and for many of us, we're just not used to that kind of change. So I think when I said I trust in the process, it's only now that the science is giving us the tools to tune our bodies and harmonize to the rate of change that we're seeing in the world while the demand for that change is emerging. And I think it's perfect symmetry, perfect timing. I don't understand everything that's happening. I don't claim to, but I do trust in the process and as I see it unfolding.
Wow, that's exciting. Global coherence sounds very intriguing. When next time we talk, we'll have to get more into that. I'm curious as if you know if there was any kind of major thing tracked on November 8th, 2016.
If there were any major, the signal broke up a little bit, and I couldn't hear what you said, Nicole.
Sorry, major energy shift tracked on November 8, 2016.
You know, it was interesting. I went back. It was not what people would have expected. I went back, and I looked at the magnetic fields. You're talking about the elections, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I went back, and I looked. Well, first I compared. I went back to Obama's first election, the very first time he was elected. And what the data showed is that there was a lot of excitement in the fields leading up to his inauguration. And on inauguration day, not so much the election, but on inauguration day, the field became very quiet. It was the global energetic field became very quiet. Scientists are reluctant to say one thing causes another. So what they will say is that something correlates with another. And there's a high correlation between a calm that flowed across the planet, at least in those magnetic fields, and when the inauguration happened, and it lasted for a few days. We didn't see that kind of change, but we also didn't see a lot of, they thought there, the scientists and many casual observers thought there might be some kind of, anxiety showing up in the field. And that didn't really show up either, at least initially. It showed up a few days, I think it was 3 or 4 days later, there started to be a lot of activity in the field. And if you go in on this website, the bright areas that you see on those 24-hour charts, that is where there's a high level of activity. And when you see the dark blues and we don't see much happening there, that is those are the quieter areas. So there was I think people were surprised at what happened during the election and inauguration. And I think maybe the field, this is my personal opinion, this isn't HeartMath saying this, my personal feeling is I think the world was surprised and was kind of, I think the magnetic fields are reflecting us kind of letting it sink in what has just happened. And it took a few days to do that. And then about 3 days later, we started seeing a lot of activity. And that's, I think, when people figured out what just happened and they said, okay, now what? What's next?
So, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, that's a very intriguing project. Wow, I was not aware of that, and now I'm on the live data, so I'm going to be on there for several hours. That's fun. Thanks for letting
so you,
us
you
know
were,
about
it. You were able to bring up the site while we're talking?
Yes. I went into Global Coherent under research and then live data. So
so you can see the live data. What's important here is this project, and I tell you, everyone is fascinated by this, U.S. military, mainstream scientists. We have never had this depth of understanding between the human body and the magnetic fields of the Earth as individuals and the collective response and our collective relationship to this field. And it goes back, it harkens back to this idea that we are part of the world rather than separate from. We are part of a living system, and we influence this system consciously or subconsciously, whether we know it or not. We're influencing it. And now we have the ability to consciously come together as a global community. And through doing something that's good for us individually, collectively, it's good for our communities and it's good for nations. And I can't think of a better time to have that ability and to breathe life into that ability. And maybe not a better way to end our program, because it looks like it's almost the top of the hour for you. So
we are there indeed. I really appreciate you, your work, your long years of dedication to bringing this information forward, and I hope you'll join me when your next book comes out by October to discuss that as well.
I would love to. All I need is an invitation, so I think I just heard one.
You did.
Yeah, Nicole, right, thank you. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, and everyone listening, I just want to thank you all for all you're doing just to be the best person you can be and to create the best world possible. I'm an optimist. I've never been more optimistic about our world, and I'm also a realist. We have a lot of work to do to bring what we know in our hearts to fruition in our lives. And I just want to say one thing about work. The prophet Khalil Gibran, the poet and the prophet and the author in the 20th century, in his book that was titled The Prophet, he wrote about work. And what he said very clearly, and I read this when I was 10 years old, and it's been with me ever since, he said, work is our love made visible. Work is love made visible. And it's going to take a lot of work to change the way we think and live. That's our love made visible. And I think we're worth it, and I think our world is worth it. So that's what I'd like to leave our listeners with today, Nicole.
Perfect. Resilience from the Heart, Greg Radin's latest book. We'll talk to him again soon. And, Greg, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much. I look forward to the next time. Take care.
I'm looking forward to it already. Greg Radin can be found online and linked up at newsforthesoul.com. This will be in the archives and re-aired on our California stations this week, and we'll go out from there. We are back with more right after this.
You're now tuned in to Nicole Whitney's News for the Soul highlights, life-changing spotlights she has shared with leading teachers in the human consciousness field since 1997. Go now to newsforthesoul.com to hear the full shows totally free. That's newsforthesoul.com.
And we love News for the Soul!
I'm feeling enormous energy around this show. Just enormous, enormous. I really have to hand it to you, Nicole. You've created sort of a niche of amazing, amazing connections. It's just like the angels and the devatas that are like attracted to News for the Soul is amazing. Like this is what's getting. It's some angel telling somebody, okay, listen, get on this show, listen to this program, even not my program, whatever program you've got on. It's really amazing.
It's hard to believe it's 17 years since there in Vancouver. And you were sitting there in class, and you were using remote viewing, and I think I said to you that you were going to be a radio talk show host or something along those lines. It wasn't really a prediction. It was just a kind of a sense of who you were and what you were doing and the direction you were going. And wow, voila, and there you were.
And still nothing.
But it's amazing. Look at what you've done with it. I just wanted to say I'm very proud of you for what you've accomplished, for just the format, to the assemblage of wonderful people, great minds, and people who are working to serve humanity and do the things that they do. I've been looking through your list of callers and interviewees, and you just do a tremendous job. I'm so proud of you. I really am. And I'm proud of all the people that support you and follow you and do what they do, and just keep doing that for this wonderful woman. It's so important, because there are not a lot of really high-quality message portals that are out there where messengers get to come in and say what they want to say in this format. So it's because of your support of her that she's able to continue doing that. So please step that up and continue doing it. And I just want to do it more. I mean, I feel good being here and being with you. I always do when I'm talking with you. So I think we just need to keep doing this more.
And we love News for the Soul!
Hello, everybody. This is Damian Brinkley. Welcome to the hearts and minds of Enfoldment. This is News for the Soul.
Hello, this is Satyan Raja, and you're listening to News for the Soul. Be open in your mind, your body, your being. Allow yourself to drench in this awesome information to evolve you to your next place.
Hey, this is Dave Morehouse, and you're listening to News for the Soul.
Yeah, man. We all love to hear the good news, so we all should rush to hear the good news. But we can just find the good news.
NSTS. News for the soul at the very best. NSTS. News for the soul at the very best. NSTS. News for the soul at the very best.
Yeah, man. Just log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Can you hear me?
We are a life-changing talk radio. We give you good news to keep you on the go. And you can also share the good news, you know. And that's the way we keep in the flow. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We not go put none of the negative in there. We not go put none of the negative in there. NFTN. News for the soul at the very best. NFTN. News for the soul at the very best. Log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Every time. Come hear the good news. Share the good news. And we all feeling good for the good news.
We are a life-changing talk radio. We give you good news to keep you on the go. And you can also share the good news, you know. And that's the way we keep in the flow. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We only focus on the positive things, yeah. We not go put none of the negative in there. We not go put none of the negative in there. NFTN. News for the soul at the very best. NFTN. News for the soul at the very best. Log on to www.newsforthesoul.com. Every time. Come hear the good news. Share the good news. And we all feeling good for the good news.
You are listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network.
And we're back, and it's time to go live again. I'm Nicole Marie Whitney, News for the Soul Radio, life-changing talk radio. From the uplifting to the unexplained, and over the many years that we've been around, we have talked to one very special scientist and author with a real gift in bridging science and spirit. Dr. Bruce Lipton is with me here for the next hour, here today on News for the Soul. And I actually can't remember the last time we talked to him live, but he's the author of Biology of Belief. And it, believe it or not, is the 10th anniversary of Biology of Belief. So we're going to be talking about that. In case you don't know, he is a stem cell biologist, best-selling author, recipient of the 2009 GOI Peace Award, and he's been a guest speaker on hundreds of TV and radio shows, including ours over the years. And like I said, bridging science and spirit, there's great power in that one place, and that's where we begin. Dr. Bruce Lipton, welcome back to News for the Soul.
Thank you so very much. I'm so happy to be back on the show, and I'm so happy to be able to talk to the wonderful audience, because they're my cultural creatives, the ones that are helping create a new civilization, and I so appreciate them.
You know, so much has happened in that field since you and I first ever spoke, and when you began on your path, it's amazing now to see the changes coming to pass that we just talked about seeing before.
Well, it for me, it's very exciting because it was an opportunity to see something, and then I had to be patient enough to wait long enough for the public to get it. But it's like, for me, it was so exciting to see a whole different understanding of the planet and the world we live in, and the nature of spirituality, which as a scientist, I never entertained that idea, really. And through the study of the cells, it was like, oh, my gosh, we're not in here. We're broadcast. And it's like, wow. So that was like an instant transformation from non-spiritual to spiritual in about a minute of like, oh, my God, that's how it works. Oh, God, I'm not in here. But
so,
yes, go ahead, darling.
What's happening? Why 10th anniversary? What's changed? Where do you want to start with this today?
Well, basically, the new edition of the book for me is kind of fun because I was asked when I was talking with Hay House, and it was like, well, it was coming up 10 years, and I thought this would be a good time to revise and update, I thought. And so they said, hey, okay, why don't we do that? Take a look at it. And for me, what was the really most exciting part, I hadn't read the book for 10 years, I guess, anyway, and I sat down and read the book, and I got to the end of it, and I said, wow, I don't have to change a word of this book. It's exactly right from the 10 years of science. And I said, but a lot has happened in the last 10 years of new stuff that is relevant to our lives. I thought, no, I really wanted to include some what has happened in 10 years. So there's an additional 40 or more pages of current things, including wonderful discussion about something called telomeres, which I presume was talked about on your show at some time, right? Telomeres? Does that make any sense?
No.
Oh, my goodness. That's
goodness.
The fountain of youth. There is an absolute fountain of youth, and that's part of the book, and then there's a lot more on the nature of how we malign the concept of cholesterol as being something bad when that's not true at all, that we blame this thing, and then we try to regulate cholesterol, which is like, oh, my God, the machine is a very complicated body inside. It's a machine, and when you start throwing drugs in there, it's sort of like throwing monkey wrenches into the machine sometimes. So the statin drugs, which people are on, is like, oh, my God, it's completely wrong. So interesting ideas about new ways of looking at life, and it comes down to also the main thing about stress. Because we look at illness and disease, and we say, oh, well, there's genetics behind it, and it comes out, well, less than 1% of disease is genetically based. And that should stop people and say, well, wait a minute, then if less than 1% comes from genetics and biology, then where does the disease come from? And it turns out lifestyle and stress. And all of a sudden that becomes really important because if we blame genes, then people just say, oh, it had nothing to do with me. It's my heredity. You know, it's like, oh, my God, my life was predetermined by those genes. And that makes people feel like they're victims. Why? Well, I didn't pick the genes, and I can't change them, and apparently you're controlling my life. And then I say, yeah, but when we understand the whole new biology is coming together, it reveals, no, we're not victims. We're actually controlling our lives, but we had no understanding of how the invisible operation of the control was going on. So we had no awareness that we were involved with every aspect of our life. And now the new biology says, oh, my goodness, we are the masters. We are the ones that control our behavior and our genetics and all aspects of our lives. But we just didn't have the understanding or programming to know that while we have that opportunity, we haven't been doing it. We've been running by programs. So this awakening is what? Going from the idea of victim of your life to the understanding that we are masters, that we can control this biology on the inside and profoundly influence every life aspect on the outside when we start to understand the new biology.
So maybe a quick recap on your original aha for the many that are still unfamiliar with your story and in many countries listening right now.
Yeah, I think, well, that's really important because this is the foundation of today. It has become a revolution in planetary awareness that changes the things we were just talking about, going from victim to master. When I was back, let's say, in 1970, and being involved with teaching in a medical school, I was teaching medical students the belief that genes control life, the idea that most people still hold anyway. I was teaching it back then. And at the same time, I was cloning stem cells, and this was like 40-some years ago. And what I found in the stem cell culture was, I would put one cell in a petri dish, one stem cell. That's an embryonic-like cell, multipotential. And I'd put one stem cell in a petri dish by itself, and it would divide every 10 hours. And after a week, you'd have about 50,000 cells because it keeps doubling and doubling. And I said, but what's interesting, there are 50,000 genetically identical cells. The experiment I did was split the cells up into three different petri dishes and change the environment a little bit in each dish. And they say, well, what's the environment? I say, well, we grow cells in culture medium, a fluid. And I go, well, why? Well, because that's the natural state inside the body. They're inside a fluid system. When you cut yourself open, the fluids leak out. So basically, cells grow in a fluid environment. And I say, well, what is the composition, or, you know, how do you make up an environment for cells? And I go, you identify the blood components from the organism where you get the cells from. So in other words, if I grow mouse cells, I make culture medium based on the blood components found in mouse blood. And when I grow human cells, I try to make culture medium, which has the same composition as human blood. So it's like they're at home. So I say, okay, what did I do? I have genetically identical cells, three dishes, but I changed the composition of the culture medium a little bit in each of the three dishes. So I have genetically identical cells, but a different environment in each dish. And the result was, in one dish, the cells form muscle. In a second dish, the cells form bone. And in a third dish, the cells form fat cells. Well, there's a very profound point here. It's like, well, who or what controlled the fate of the cells? Point. They were all genetically identical, so it wasn't built into the genes where this program unfolded from. They all had the same genes. It turned out it was the environment. And the relevance about that is, here I am in the classroom teaching students genes are making decisions. Genes turn on and off. Genes control life. And then I find out in my research, it's like, that's not true at all. It's like, whoa. Basically, that was some pioneering work. Today's field of science that is really focusing on what I was seeing 40 years ago is called epigenetics. And you say, well, it sounds like genetics. I go, well, here's the difference. When I was teaching in medical school, I was teaching what was called genetic control, simply control by genes. I say, but today the science is not called genetics, it's called epigenetics. And I say, well, what's the epi? I say, oh, epi means above. So I say, oh, then when I talk about today, epigenetic control, I'm saying control above the genes. This is the whole remarkable evolution. We were thinking genes turn on and off. That's a total false statement. Genes are blueprints. They have no more activity than a blueprint in an architect's office. They're just patterns. But the idea about it is something selects the patterns and selects the programming above the genes. And that's what we're beginning to find out. It's the environment that is adjusting the biology so that whatever's going on in the environment influences your biology. So you walk outside and it's warm out and the skin feels warm. The biology adjusts itself now to cool down the body. Oh, you walk outside when it's cold out. Oh, when you feel the environment of cold, the body adjusts itself to make itself warm. So the body is adjusting itself to the environment. And I say, well, why is that relevant? And I go, well, some environments are very healthy and some environments are not very healthy. And when we get sick, we have a tendency to say, oh, the genes and the biology are the problem. Now we know that over 90% of illness is not due to the genes at all. Less than 1% of illness is due to genes. And so where's the illness coming from? And it says the environment, and here's the catch, Nicole. It's not just environment, but our perception of the environment. And I say this becomes very important because The environment, hot, cold outside, directly affects the temperature of the body straight on one to the other. But if there's something going on in your life and you have a vision of it, you have a perception, oh, is this good or is this bad? Is this threatening or is this loving? That's a perception at that moment. And I say, why is it relevant? Because whatever you're seeing is turned into chemistry that goes into the blood, and the blood is the culture medium that controls the genetics and the behavior. So here's the simplest understanding, and it's so profound. It works like this, is that the chemical composition of the blood controls the fate and genetics of the cell. And then I say the brain is the thing that creates the chemistry in the blood. And then I say, yeah, but what chemical should the brain put into the blood? And I say, well, whatever picture is in the mind. And when we were younger, we probably played with something called paint by numbers, where you get a picture with outlines and numbers in it, and you get a set of paints with numbers on each different color, and then you put the colors into the spaces, and then lo and behold, you create this masterpiece of art. And I say, you know what's interesting, and this is how simple life is. I love how simple it becomes, and it's like this. The mind, brain, and blood relationship is paint by numbers in reverse, meaning you first start with a picture in your mind, and then the brain breaks the picture down into numbers, but instead of paints, the numbers represent neurohormones and growth factors and regulators and immune system controls and all these things. So in other words, your mind sees a picture, your brain breaks it down into a complement to that picture in regard to nerve secretions. And that then goes into the body and controls the behavior. So what's the point? Your biology is a reflection of what you see going on in the world. And if you change how you see the world, you change your biology and you change your genetics. A wonderful insight, which is mentioned in the book, is Dean Ornish, an internist from San Francisco, has done a lot of wonderful work. He took his prostate cancer patients, split them into two groups. He read the genetic readout of both groups of patients at the start. One group got the regular medical treatment, whatever the drugs and stuff that was, and the other group got no drugs or anything. What they got was lifestyle changes. They learned how to eat a better diet. They learned how to reduce stress. They learned how to meditate. And 90 days after the start of the experiment, they then read the genes of both groups, and the drug gene people, the genes stayed exactly the same as they were, but in the group that did lifestyle change, 500 genes, many of them directly associated with the prostate cancer, changed their function in that 90-day period of what? Just changing lifestyle. So there's the beautiful part about all of this, Nicole, is that we're transitioning in a world where we have been taught to believe we are victims, victims of our heredity, and that when you're a victim, you give up responsibility because you have no control anyway, and also then you give up your savings to anybody who says they're going to help you with your problem, and then I say, and what's happening today? And it turns around, no. If we understand how the mechanism works now, it's how our thoughts and our beliefs and our mind are translated by the biology into the chemistry of our blood, which is then controlling behavior and genetics. And if we know that, just as we just said, then it basically says this, what if you change your behavior? And I go, well, then you change your biology at that point. And all of a sudden it says, oh my goodness, then we are masters of our biology. We're not victims of anything. The only thing we're victims of is the belief that we're victims, and that's wrong. So this is an exciting time, a revolution on the planet, especially when you consider the healthcare crisis, the money, the amount of money that we're spending to bring people to health through a model that says, oh, it's just a broken genes and broken body, and give them some chemistry and they'll come back. And then find out it had nothing to do with that, except for 1%, but it had to do with our lifestyle, our beliefs, our spirituality, our attitudes about life, love, diet, and exercise. There you go. And those are things we can control. And if you understand we can control it, then it says, oh, well, then you don't have to be unhealthy if you don't want to be.
because we can change our environment and we can change our perceptions.
Which is huge, of course, why you're you and what you're doing. The perceptions, are they as easy to change as you're suggesting?
Yes, when you have knowledge of how to change them. If you don't have an understanding, then it's one of the more difficult processes in our lives because there's a mechanism, and we have to understand. Let me just give you the idea of how powerful a perception is, because it's in some stage shows with hypnosis. They hypnotize an individual, and they tell that person, we're going to touch you with a burning cigarette on your arm. And under that state of hypnosis, that individual under hypnosis perceives that's what happened, but the person only touched them with their finger, just, you know, touched their arm with their finger. And within a minute or two, a blister begins to form. And it's like, didn't just form anywhere, formed exactly where the person got touched. And you stop for a second and say, how can you accommodate that? How does you make any sense out of that? Because the logic thing, obviously the skin did not get burned at all. And you say, well, but the blister formed exactly where you touched it. And the answer was this. The perception of the mind saw a burn, and the mind controlled the biology to manifest the blister. And all of a sudden you say, oh, my God, look, I can manifest a blister, and it never really occurred. And I go, this is why we have to really understand why our perceptions are so important, because if they're negative perceptions, without our even understanding it, we are translating those into a negative status of our health. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, my God, to get the health back, they say, well, we'll go to the doctor, we'll get some drugs. I go, no, you want the health back is take away the negative image, take away that perception. Very simply, you know, I'm sorry I keep talking so much, Nicole, but I'm trying to get this out, how simple this is. When I was learning how to grow cells in tissue culture, one of the first things I learned was this, was that after I put the cells into the culture, the procedure of getting them and then putting them into culture, I put the dishes in the incubator overnight and come back and look at them in the morning. And my major advisor at the time in teaching me how to do this said, when you come back in the morning, if the cells don't look good, that means, you know, they're not healthy looking and they don't look right, don't blame the cells. First, look at the conditions of the culture medium. And why that was relevant was at some point was I didn't even know it, but years later that's what the epigenetic science ultimately came to say, was that it's the environment that is manifesting that. So I take a dish of healthy cells, put it in a less than optimum environment, and the cells start to get sick and die. And then if there was a cell doctor, he'd say, oh, yeah, Bruce, your cells are sick. Well, yeah, we should get a prescription and give them some drugs. And I go, no, all you have to do is take the cells from the bad environment, move them into the good environment, and they will instantly get healthy again. The point, the cells become a complement to the...
Oops. That was weird.
Yeah.
I got cut off. I'm back. Well, it sounds so simple. So,
we didn't talk about changing, but that's how simple it works. I mean, that's the amazing part. It's like, we can imagine all kinds of complexities why my life turned out this way. And if you leave out this first understanding is that your perceptions are creating this unfolding, then we're really lost because we're trying to figure out how the outside did that to me when we had responsibility at some point. Hello?
You sort of cut out for a minute. We're getting intermittent glitches. So just the last 10 seconds cut out.
Okay, you can edit that?
Well, no, we're live.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you got to go with the flow, you know. So.
That's right.
It's important for us to recognize that if we own that we have responsibility, then it means we own that we can do something about it. And as you brought up, changing the perceptions, and as you also brought up, it seems to be very hard because so many people have difficulty in changing it. You know, you read all the self-help books, you go to the videos and watch the lectures, you do all these things, and no matter how much learning you get about how it should be, it hardly changes. And after, oh my God, it changes hard. Well, to break it down, let's make it understanding about this. The mind, which is controlling the system, is actually comprised of two independent parts that are connected together. One is called the subconscious mind, and that mind is the equivalent of a record playback device, like a CD recorder. You record something, you push play, and it plays it back. Every time you do it, it plays it back, same thing over and over again. So the subconscious mind is like the habit mind. The latest evolution of the brain is right behind your forehead, a lobe of brain tissue called the prefrontal cortex, and associated with that was the development of the conscious mind. I said, well, what's the difference? Well, as I said, the subconscious mind is a habit mind. It learns behavior, stimulus, response, and that's how it, you know, its life is managed. But when you get to the conscious mind, something's totally different, and the idea is that it can think, number one. It's not just stimulus, response, it can think. But, and number two, it can see into the future or look into the past. It can review the past or it can look into the future. And I say, well, why is this relevant? Because the conscious mind, here's the difference. The conscious mind is a creative mind. Because I can say, well, what do you want to do on Monday? And it's not Monday yet. You obviously are creating something for Monday, so it's creative. And I go, yes, and here's the interesting part about it. It's the mind that's also connected to you as a personal identity, the connection to your spirituality, your source, who you are, is playing through this mind. So it's you and it's creative. So I say, oh, cool. So I say the conscious mind has your wishes and desires in it. And so if I say, what do you want out of your life? You're looking, say, in the future I want X. You're creating an idea. So wishes, desires, aspirations, conscious mind, habits, subconscious mind. Okay, and then I say, okay, here's the difference. The subconscious mind learns in a different way than the conscious mind. The conscious mind, because it's creative, can learn from, as we mentioned, reading a book, going to a lecture, watching a video, just going, aha, and the conscious mind can learn something. I go, well, this is not the same as the subconscious. I go, no, subconscious is a habit mind. And that means this. When you put in a habit, you don't want it to change, especially if it's an important habit, like walking, for example. If you learned how to walk, you don't want that to change. So the habit mind is resistant to change, firstly, okay? And it doesn't learn in the same way. It's not creative. It has to learn in a different way. So here's the issue. We now recognize that the subconscious mind in the first 7 years of life is downloading life experiences straight into the subconscious. In other words, the conscious mind of a child is not really fully engaged until around age 7, when the brain develops another higher level of function. Below age 7, the brain activity of the child is mainly in a wavelength called theta, which is below consciousness. It's imagination, in fact, and that's why kids, especially, you know, 2 to 7, can mix the real world and imaginary world because their brain operating at theta is that zone, but that zone is also hypnosis. And you say, why should the brain be in hypnosis? And the answer is simply this. There's so much you can program with genes. And culture, you can't program with genes. It changes all the time, so there's no genes for how to behave. And yet, when you're born into a family, the first thing you've got to learn is how to be a functional member of the family and then a functional member of the community. And I say, well, how many rules is that? And all of a sudden you say, well, it's thousands of rules. And I go, okay, teach a two-year-old. Here, sit down. I got to teach you a few thousand rules here about how to be a functional member of the family. It's like, well, that's not going to work. But it works for this reason. Nature designed the brain to be in a record mode for 7 years. Recording what? The behavior of the mother, the father, the family, the community. Why? It's observing behavior and learning how the interactions occur, how a parent talks to a child is different than how they talk to each other, which is different than how they talk to the neighbor, which is even different than how they talk to a policeman. It's like, wow, the child learns all these, but doesn't learn them by reading or anything. It learns them by just recording, 7 years of recording. And that's why the first 7 years is download. Then consciousness begins, and then consciousness can use the data to make a life from it. But first you have to put the data in. So I say, well, the relevance then is the data that went into the subconscious mind in the first 7 years, A, is other people's behavior because you were recording other people. So that's A. B, you weren't conscious of the recording because your conscious brain wasn't working anyway at that point. So you didn't see this download occurring, okay? So it wasn't filtered. It was just whatever you saw was the download. And most importantly, it was a period where the brain was in theta, which is called hypnosis, okay? After seven, the conscious brain kicks in. The subconscious is no longer working on hypnosis at this point, okay? Now it's working on life experiences of live, what you're doing, okay? It changes the direction of it. But the relevance is this. If the subconscious learned in the first 7 years through a process called hypnosis, but after 7 years, it learns in a different way. And what it learns by is repetition, habit. That's what's called the habit mind. So if you want to change a program after you're age seven, you have to make a habit, like an exercise, and you've got to repeat that habit, just like learning how to drive a car or learning how to walk. You had to learn. You had to do it every day, repeat it till you get it down. Or the ABCs. How many times did you start A and never could finish until you learned the next couple of letters, and then you kept progress until you could get to Z, and now guess what? Once you learned it, you don't have to do it again. So the nature of repetition is after seven, okay? So I say, well, you want to change the subconscious mind. How do most people try to do it? First big mistake is they attempt to talk to themselves. It's like, oh, you're talking to yourself. Well, Bruce, don't eat that donut. You know, it's really bad. It's really, you know, don't do that. So I'm talking to myself. Don't eat my donut there. And then 10 minutes later, I'm standing there with a donut in my hand going, oh, you know, you didn't listen to me. What's going on here? You know, what the heck are you doing with a donut? And then I go, here's the point. The subconscious mind is a recording device that is recording these habits. It's a machine. There's nobody in there. Point. If you're talking to yourself, then presumably somebody's listening to you. You say, well, who's listening? You say, well, the subconscious is listening. I go, no. You see, subconscious is a machine. There's nobody in there. So if you want to change a recording on a disc, you can put the disc into the machine, and you can talk to the machine all you want. It's never going to change anything. And that's the most frustrating thing, because we can see what we want to change. We know what we want to change. We tell ourselves, and yet it doesn't work. And I say, why? Subconscious mind doesn't learn that way. It learns A, through hypnosis, or B, through repetition. And I'm going to add a third one right now because it's really important. There's a whole new field, and this is the exciting one, called energy psychology. And energy psychology is are modalities of changing subconscious programs that rely on super learning processes. And you say, super learning? I go, yeah. Maybe you've seen somebody read a book by moving their finger down the page. As fast as they move the finger down, they read every word on the page, and they flip through a book, and they can read a book in minutes. That's an expression of super learning. I say, what's the point? I say, with some of these modalities, you can change a belief you had your whole life in about 10 or 15 minutes. And
no,
it's like, wow, this is pretty exciting. I go, yeah, we've had problems changing beliefs from before. For what reason? Way? Because we thought that the conscious mind, subconscious mind were one and the same. So if the conscious mind became aware of something, of course the subconscious mind should have followed along. Okay, first mistake. No, they're two separate minds. Second, we believe that, well, one mind can talk to the other mind. I go, okay, false. Because you, the talker, in the conscious mind, is trying to talk to the subconscious when it's just a machine. Nobody's in there. So that's why the failure of that, okay? And then what we have to recognize is, in the subconscious mind learns in different ways. It, as I said, hypnosis, repetition, and now energy psychology. So I say, you want to activate change? Well, there are three fundamental ways you can do it. Number one, in the old days, it was called subliminal tapes. Maybe they're called subliminal CDs now. Basically, you put earphones on as you're going to bed, and you have a tape that gives a relaxation exercise followed by a belief statement you want to download about your life. And what's interesting is you go to sleep, and as you're going from awake to sleep, you pass through theta, the function of the brain of hypnosis. Your conscious mind doesn't hear what the tape is playing. The subconscious is hearing what the tape is playing. So as you have the earphones on at night, And as you're starting to go off to sleep, and the conscious mind checks out, the subconscious mind is now hearing a new program repeatedly put in, so it's making a new program, bypassing consciousness. So that's one way. Number two, as I said, repetition. Well, if you want to do something different, then you have to just repeat the process. And at first it's a struggle. Why? Because you're trying to create something against an old habit. But the idea of repetition of a new habit creates the new habit. I can remember, I'm old enough to remember before there were seatbelts in the car, and nobody ever drove with seatbelts. Then all of a sudden there was a law, you have to put a seatbelt on. It's like every time I put the belt on, oh my God, I hate this stupid belt, and I would fuss over it all the time. And at some point of doing that for how long, I don't know how long it was, then all of a sudden it was like, it was so automatic that I get in the car, I don't even have a discussion about it in my head. I automatically put the seatbelt on before I can drive the car because it's now a habit. Okay, so habits start out begrudgingly, but when you repeat them, you're making a new recording, and that recording will override the old recording. So that's a second way of changing it. And then I say the energy psychology modalities, and they're very interesting because a couple of the ones that I know have profound effects on the brain that you can put a person, wire their head with the EEG to read their brain activity, and they go through one of what they're called balances or whatever process to make a belief change. You can put the wires on the person's head, and a friend of mine does this, a neuroscientist, and he has people in the audience, and somebody wants to have a change of belief, he brings them up to the front, he puts on the wires, and he has projected above the person on the screen the live EEG of the brain. And what's very interesting about it is the person goes through a belief change process, and the audience can see the change occur in the EEG while it's happening. It's like, oh, my God, look, it happened. Even before the individual on the stage acknowledges it, the audience could see when the change occurred. So basically it sounds like New Age woo-woo, but we now can record these changes that occur. They're very profound. And for me, I've always lived by this old saying, necessity is the mother of invention. And interestingly, we're at a stage of our evolution where necessity says we must change our beliefs fast. And that new invention is energy psychology.
So I'm unclear on exactly what is it like affirmations and things, or is it something new?
No, it's a little deeper than that. It usually involves some processing to engage the super learning process. I know one very well because for years, I engaged the process in my own life, and if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have been able to write that book 10 years ago because I had so much trouble with the belief system that I was a conventional research scientist, and, you're standing in the community is based on how others view you in the community. And my subconscious mind had a knowledge that said, if you write this book, you're going to alienate all those people that validate you as a researcher. And so my subconscious mind kept sabotaging writing the book because I saw that this would be a problem. And so I did a belief check, and sure enough, that's what I found that the belief was protecting me from losing my scientific status. And I had to put in a new belief, and that's one of the first times I used this process called Psyche. And I rewrote a new belief about writing the book and getting it done, no problem, and all that. And within the shortest time, within 2 or 3 months after that, the book was done. So it was removing a block that was unconsciously trying to protect me by saying, if you do this, this is bad. and I had to get that block out. And so I tried it, and it was like a 10-minute process or something like that. It was totally amazing. But the idea about it was that how does this one work? Well, I know because you get into a posture, and it's called the whole brain posture. And you cross your arms and your legs, and why it's important is because from before age 7, when all that learning that the child is downloading, how quickly they can download all kinds of stuff, like a 3-year-old in a family that has 3 different languages running in the family, a 3-year-old will pick out and learn all 3 languages as independent languages. And I say, yeah, but after a child is, let's say, 8 or 9, you try and teach one new language, and all of a sudden you're up against the wall. And you say, well, how did the 3-year-old do it? And the 8 or 9-year-old couldn't do it. And I say, before age 7, our brains, left and right hemispheres, work in harmony with each other. After age 7, there's a wave cycle that sometimes during the day you're more in the left brain, and then sometimes during the day you're more in the right brain, and then it goes back to the left brain. It's like a wave going sometimes left, sometimes right, left, right, left, right. And I say, well, this is profoundly important because each hemisphere of the brain is associated with different characteristics. So let's say my left brain is logical and my right brain is emotional. And I say, well, what's significant? I say, well, sometimes during the day I'm operating from my left brain. I'm more logical about everything I do. And sometimes during the day, emotional things affect me much more than logical things. And I say, well, what's the issue? I said, super learning, or that learning when the child before 7 was associated with both hemispheres working at the same time. As adults, we have trouble. And the reason is this, because the system is designed to go through the wave of left, right, left, and right. And if you want to put in a new learning program, it turns out if you can synchronize the brain so that both hemispheres are firing at the same time, that logic and emotion are now integrated into the program, you can rapidly download a new program. So many of the exercises involve, or the modalities involve, similar kinds of exercises or something to do to engage this process. And this is very exciting because, as I said, it's a necessity for us in this stage of our evolution. We're facing some very serious civilization problems right now, and we have to empower ourselves. And as we talked about, there's 2 levels of empowerment right now. Number 1, epigenetics is, yeah, you're in control of this, and if you understand it, you can manifest it. And B, that collectively our behavior as a culture is undermining civilization, that we're going extinct, and it's not 1,000 years from now. You know, they're talking about like civilization collapsing within 20 years. This is reality, and the reason why is our behavior, human behavior, is undermining the web of life and humanity itself. And so we're in need of what? A rapid makeover, a rapid redo, a rapid change this program, and get out of the belief that life is a struggle for survival, and get out of this belief that you're a victim of your biology, and re-empower yourselves. And then when we do that, it'll change the world. And I just love it because one of my books is called The Honeymoon Effect. And it basically says, look, our lives may really just be a struggle all the way up, and to a point we meet this one person, and we fall in love. And then, like, the next day, it's like heaven on earth. You know, it's this period called the honeymoon effect where, God, it's so beautiful. Life is so great. I go, you know, it was a struggle until the night before, and the next day, all of a sudden, it starts to become heaven on earth. I say, what's that all about? And here's what the answer is. As I said, 95% of our life is coming from the subconscious programs. And the reason for that is because our conscious mind is thinking 95% of the day. And because it's thinking, it's not paying attention. When it's not paying attention, you don't stop whatever you're doing, driving the car, walking, whatever you're doing. You continue doing it, but now it's not controlled by the conscious. It's controlled by the subconscious program. It's default. I go, so it turns out 95% of the day we're thinking, so 95% of the day we're playing subconscious programs. Yes, they came from other people, so they're not our beliefs and wishes and desires. And we're manifesting 95% of the day a life that we've been programmed to live, what we can do and what we can't do, etc. And then I say, so what happened when you fell in love? And this is the fun part about the movie The Matrix, which is, as I mentioned, it's catalog of science fiction, but for me it's a documentary. Yes, we've been programmed for 7 years of our life, and they talk about taking a red pill and getting out of the program. I say, you know what? We now know that falling in love is the red pill. We get out of the subconscious programming for a reason, and the reason is simple. when you have someone you find after you're looking your whole life, you have this one person in front of your face, the one you love, you don't let your mind wander. You keep your mind present, mindful. I go, why is that relevant? Well, our life up until that moment was being run only 5% by mindful and 95% by subconscious. And then after you fall in love, that moment you fall in love, it switches around, and now your life is run 90% or more from the conscious mind and less than 10% from the subconscious. And I feel, well, what's the relevance of that? And I go, up till the moment you fell in love, your life was the readout, printout of a program that you got. The moment you fell in love was taking the red pill. Why? You stopped playing the program because you didn't default to the subconscious because you were mindful. And I said, well, what was the consequence of being mindful without playing the program? I said, the honeymoon, heaven on earth. I go, well, wait a minute. So the heaven on earth is a reality except when you play the program. I go, yeah. And so when people change the program, we can take this, what looks like hell on earth, and everyone could live honeymoon on earth. It's the same earth. It's just an attitude change. So this is why we're so moving toward an evolutionary upheaval, and it's an evolution upheaval, not in biology, not in genetics, but in consciousness. It just says we have to learn we can get out of the program. We can create new programs, and using the subliminal tapes, using the repetition habit thing, or using energy psychology. These are all ways that you can rewrite any of the programs in your life that you got in the first 7 years that are causing you problems. And I'm going to keep talking now for another second, Nicole, because I came up with something interesting about it. It's like, you say, well, wait, where I got these programs. And I say, well, what are the programs? And you go, well, wait, the program started when you were in the last trimester of pregnancy and continued through the first 7 years. So I say, well, you got a lot of programming before you were born. You got programming in your first year, tremendous quantity, second year. And I just say, hey, Nicole, tell me what thing you learned when you were 1 year old. What's the program that you learned? You go, I have no idea what the program was at 1 year old. Why? Well, the conscious mind wasn't even really working until around seven at some point. I mean, it has memories, but it's not conscious memories much. We'll talk about that. But why is it relevant? Because I say, well, what are the programs that you got in your subconscious mind that could be sabotaging your life? You say, well, I don't really know because I wasn't conscious when I got the programs. And then I go, okay, now to make life easy again, our lives are, by definition, 95% coming from the subconscious. So by definition, your life is essentially a printout of your subconscious programs. I say, well, what does that mean? I say, well, look, anything you like that comes easily into your life comes there because you have a program that allows them to be there. In contrast, and this is the one, anything you work hard at, anything you struggle over, anything you put effort into, anything you sweat over, why are you working so hard? The answer? Inevitably, you have a program that doesn't support that conclusion. And I say, well, then why is this, what's the importance of that? I understand. I say, good. You don't need a lot of analysis. All you have to do is look at your life and say, what part isn't working? and then just look for the program on that part and change that part. You don't have to go back and say, who did what to make the program? Who, when, and how did it happen? That just makes it replay again. That just irritates that. That's why you got to have so much Kleenex when you go to the shrink there, It's like, now is this. There's an old saying, don't kill the messenger over the message. Point is simply this. The program in your mind is the message. How you got the message, that's totally irrelevant. You're living with the message. So basically deal with the message, and the idea is then don't go backwards in your life. Look at where you are now and make a list and understanding of what are the things that don't come easily to you that you want. And I say, well, and then I would check a belief about having those things, because there almost inevitably will be a belief that will not support it, and you are sabotaging yourself 95% of the day when those subconscious beliefs are actually playing. Okay, I think I ran that spiel out, Nicole.
But I just like to let you go so we can cram as much in there, but you said something that obviously needs to be highlighted and underscored. So we have to get out of this survival victim programming now to to avoid a collapse of humanity in about 20 years. Is that what I heard you say?
Absolutely. We now know that, and I know the estimates have been longer than reality. The scientists are finding that the things they were predicting are happening faster than their original predictions. And one of them, for example, is, how about this? No saltwater fish in the ocean in 2048. I go, that's not that long from now. You know, it's like, listen, tell your grandchildren there used to be fish in the ocean at one point. No, because we're overfishing and destroying the breeding grounds and polluting the water and all that. It's like it's on its way out. That half the wildlife that was on this planet in 1970 doesn't exist anymore. We lost half the animals on this planet since 1970.
Half?
Half. It's actually 52%.
And
all of this. Why? It turns out human behavior. We're undermining ecosystems. We're pillaging the planet. We're taking all the resources and polluting and destroying. And we think like, oh, we have no effect on it. It's like, no, we are causing, and this is a fact of science. So I'm going to say this is a fact of science. And that is this. We are into what is called the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet. Five times in the history of this planet, life was thriving, and then some catastrophic thing happened, and 50 to 80% of all the wildlife on the planet disappeared, just, you know, gone. And they attribute things like maybe asteroids hitting or comets hitting the Earth and upsetting the environment, or massive geological activity, volcanoes, earthquakes, and stuff like that. And they say when they're looking at the loss of species today, it is greater than, and faster than the loss of species in the previous mass extinction. And we're at a level now where it's now mass extinction approaching because the organisms are getting lost. As I said, 52% of the animals are gone. And so all of a sudden it really says is that we are in a process called the sixth mass extinction of life. But, and yet science, as I said, has knows what the cause is. It's human behavior. And then all of a sudden it says, well, if you want to stop the sixth mass extinction, then we must stop human behavior the way it's working because it's destructive of not just the humans but of the planet in which we live. And we're destroying ourselves and the planet. So we see all these crises, and to me this is very important. You look at the crises. There's economic crisis. You know, we have a healthcare crisis. We have government crises here, climate change crisis here, and you start to make a list of them, and you go, wow. And I go, you see what the illusion is that these are all separate things, and the fact is, no, they're all connected to one thing, and that is us, and that's connected to the sixth mass extinction. So what are we seeing? We're seeing things like, let's say, a monetary crisis or a fuel crisis or, you know, food crisis, which is happening now. And I say, well, what happens when you get these crises? And the answer is this. You cannot continue the way you have been doing things because it won't work that way anymore. You hit a wall. You must change. Ah, the word change. That means we change the way we live in order to survive. That, by definition, means we're changing civilizations because the way we have been living and the cultural beliefs of this civilization are responsible for this collapse. And so when you look at the world and you see all those bad headlines and everybody going, oh, my God, it's so scary. And I go, no, you don't get it. This is good news. It's good news for the reason is this. The system has to break down to build a new system. We can't fix this old one because that's the one that caused the problems. The more you try and fix it, the more you keep the problems going. So while people are looking in fear, I really want to say, wait a minute. You're focusing your efforts and energy on the wrong side. You should be focusing your efforts and energy on the side of where's the change? Where do we go from here? How is this going to be? And I'm going to tell you what. All the people that I started to know, being myself one of them, stepping outside of the box and living in a different way, have found that there's a much kinder and gentler planet outside of the conventional world if you get out of the programming. And the reason why this is important is because the evolution means that the system is going to collapse, and it's required because if it doesn't, extinction is right in front of you right now. So when you look at it, if you look at it in fear, as I say, this is Remember, the picture in your mind makes your health. Part of the illnesses of this planet is to be in fear of these changes, because the picture of fear means threat, and the threat changes the chemistry of your body into protection, and that will actually shut down your growth and your immune system. And in fact, that's one of the biggest causes of problems on today's world, the fear. So if you look at the crises as fear, you're not helping yourself or the planet. If you think about it, I look at the crises as good. There are other ways to solve this thing. There's another way to do life better than this thing and the way we've been living, and it's changing. So when you look at the world and you see all the upheaval, it's, yeah, because we're in a transition state from an old type of civilization, the one we were in, scientific materialism based on matter, and moving into a more holistic civilization where energy, which includes spirit, is brought back into the equation, because we've left that out of the picture. So we're moving into a new civilization right now. And that's why when I got on, you know, when we started the call today and I mentioned cultural creatives, because the people that are listening to your show, Nicole, which is very important, this show is saying, look, there is life outside the box. There are other ways of living. And the sooner you learn it, the more prosperous your life will be. Because if you resist the learning, it's going to hurt. Because things are not happy if you resist it. So my message is, okay, we can change our way, look at the world, start to recognize that what do you want from life versus what the program said you would be. And this is a time of great flux and change, an opportunity to rewrite the programs, create the new world, and move out of this collapsing one into a civilization that we can thrive into. That's what's in front of us.
And that's really what we have been doing, but you're saying we need to really bring it now.
Well, yeah, there's talk, and then we got to do the action part of it. And I know that from my own self. You know, look, yeah, when that biology belief came in my head and I understood the nature, oh, my God, how my perceptions and beliefs and attitudes control my life, I got so excited and wanted to go out and tell everybody, because I thought, well, tomorrow the world will change when everybody knows this. And I'd get whatever I could, people would gather together, and I'd give a lecture and say, if you understand what I'm talking about, you can have the most wonderful life on this planet. And then that audience in those early days, they'd look at me and cock their heads and go, you know, lifting your life doesn't look so good for a guy who says you know this stuff. And that was the big wake-up call, Nicole, because I almost said, well, do as I say, not as I do. And then I realized, oh, my God, here you've got this great secret of life. You want to tell everybody else about it. You're not doing it. Mm-hmm. I realized, yeah, here's the difference. You can create all that knowledge in your conscious mind, but if you don't apply it in your behavior and you don't apply it in your life, then it's like information up on the top for a trivia game someday, but you haven't done anything. And that's what I had to do, is like, wait, now that I know how it works, I now have to manifest a life using these principles. And God, I have to tell you, I mean, look, my last book was called The Honeymoon Effect. Why? Well, when you start to see Earth as heaven, where you came to create, it changes everything about the way we live on this planet.
Well, holy smokes, the time has just zipped by us. That's a perfect pause moment, though, isn't it? heaven on Earth, that's a lot better than destruction of total humanity.
It's a good destination, and joy will be there, and happiness, and love, and community sharing. I see it, because I've been around the world, and I've seen people moving in that direction, and been in communities where things like that are going on. It's like, oh, my God, sometimes we think this is never going to happen. And what we don't realize, Nicole, is that there are so many groups out there, so many shows such as your own, providing this new information, and we don't see the other ones, and therefore we look and say, yeah, I guess we're the only ones here, and it turns out, no, we have large numbers of us all over the planet, but they're not connected yet, but in one, you know, it could be overnight, just like a Berlin Wall, boom, they all decide to connect, and the world will change the next day, just like what happened in the Berlin Wall coming down.
That's a beautiful vision, and we need people like you out there waking people up and treading these new paths, and so we can see the vision and hold it together. It's very important. You know, we didn't really get to the 40 pages, and you mentioned Fountain of Youth. I can't leave it hanging.
Oh, my goodness.
We have to have you back.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that would be That would be wonderful. Fountain of Youth is a good story because it's real. Okay.
I want to hear it. So we've got it.
Okay, that's good. Now that means a future invitation. I'm ready.
It does. That's exactly what it means. So, oh my gosh, there's a show right behind us here. We've got about 60 seconds to the top here. So, Dr. Bruce Lipton, how do they get your updated Biology of Belief book?
Amazon, bookstores everywhere, my website, which is simple, brucelipton.com. Most any bookstore should have it, and I really hope people take a look at it because it's a book of knowledge of self, and knowledge is power. Therefore, Biology of Belief is knowledge of self-empowerment, and that's what it really is, a tool, knowledge to change your life.
Ta-da! Well, there you go. I will be emailing your office today with potential lead times because, of course, we've left on a big cliffhanger. We all want to hear about the Fountain of Youth and all the other good stuff. So we will talk to you soon.
I hope so. Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thanks so much for being here. It's always a pleasure. Dr. Bruce Lipton, author of Biology of Belief and the new 10th anniversary edition with those mysterious extra pages, is now out. So look that up. We'll post it up on our site as well, newsforthesoul.com, and we're back with more right after this. This is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. And it's a great honor to have you on the show tonight. Welcome, Deepak Chopra.
Thank you.
Yes, this is Uri.
Hi, Uri. It's Nicole Whitney calling News for the Soul. Welcome to News for the Soul, Robert Allen.
Thank you, Nicole. It's great to be here with you tonight.
Why are you here? We're talking to Carolyn Mace about Sacred Contracts, one of her many best-selling books. Welcome to the show, Greg Braden.
Well, good evening, Nicole. It's certainly a pleasure to hear your voice and a pleasure to be here tonight.
Welcome to the show, Stuart Wild.
Thank you very much.
John Kehoe, welcome to News for the Soul.
Hey, how are you?
Next up, Dr. David Morehouse.
I'm so glad that you called me because you are doing such an important task, important work, because you are spreading a very positive message.
I was really moved by last week's show because we made a commitment to a worldwide event to try to change consciousness.
I'm feeling enormous energy around this show, just enormous, enormous. I really have to hand it to you, Nicole. You've created sort of a niche of amazing, amazing connections. It's just like the angels and the devatas that are like attracted to News for the Soul is amazing.
Hello, everybody. This is Damian Brinkley. Welcome to the hearts and minds of Enfoldment. This is News for the Soul.
I mean, that was weird. I don't think about Art Bell every day.
I passed at 10:30 in the morning, so you don't ever know.
He was in the afternoon. When he popped in here, it was mid-afternoon.
Then he wasn't alive then.
Right.
So, you know, here's Art. Punched in on the chat room on the day he died. I said, "Well, that doesn't really mean that he was really alive."
You know, I was thinking that of all the people out there who would find a way to.
Oh, he'll do it. He'll come back. He'll do it. He'll find a way. He said, "Let's go get the mail," and he had bought him a Grand Am Trans Am, 400 horsepower. Okay. 4-speed when it was brand new, and we went and got the mail at 142 miles an hour. Okay, and that was that joy. Art was about art. Art's ability to openly, consciously explore realities based on the credibility of the research he had done on the person that's on the air. This is how he was. There was no casualness about it. He was ready. And and he was worried. He was worried about this drought he had seen and that people were going through. And he went on the radio and he decided that he was going to try to use the power of prayer because it had been something we had talked about. And you know, what were those possibilities? Because we would talk about it. He'd hear a show that he thought was important, and there was me, there was to me and another two other people that he would talk to about it. And so he decided he was going to get all of the Coast to Coast people, it was probably 15 million people that would listen to the show, so 13 million people that would listen to the show. And so Art set up prayer. He set up a prayer for rain, and it started raining the next day.
I remember.
And it rained like for 5 or 6 days, okay? That was my favorite one because all of a sudden I was calling him Art God. And, mm-hmm. and but he had nowhere to go, Nicole.
I remember that consciousness experiment with the Joe, and it was interesting how he explored that afterwards because he became afraid that it wasn't supposed to
be. It scared the crap out of him.
I know.
It scared the crap out of him. I had to listen to it for like a week, you know, and he has to come off his high horse. I was in such pain in that brain surgery thing in 97. Nicole, you know, that was like, oh, my God. When I blew my brain out and subdual hematomas and I was crushing, Art got people to pray for me, and I never knew this until later. I never knew this till later. But at about 2 o'clock one morning or like 3 o'clock one morning and when I couldn't take it anymore, the room cleared. This is in the hospital bed. The room cleared. There was no noise or any of that. And knowing that I thought I was going to die from it, the brain surgery, because you'd have to do open heart surgery and brain surgery at the same time, and there was no way I could make it through it. So Art got people to pray. And I know the moments because I could organize my life. I could get away from the pain, and I could organize my life. And that went on for like 3 or 4 hours before it all came back, the pain came back. And it was at the exact same time that Art had gone on the air.
Welcome to News for the Soul's 20th anniversary broadcast series. News for the Soul, the longest running spiritual empowerment and exploration broadcast in North America, started its 21st year in January 2018, and we're just getting warmed up. It's time to take it to the next level, exploring the edge of human consciousness and possibility on planet Earth in our 21st year with founder and journalist Nicole Marie Whitney at the helm. What's really real and what's really possible? That is what we want to know. So if you're ready to find out together, get ready for life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. Platinum Edition. Here is News for the Soul.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show. And we are live. It is Saturday, April 21st, 2018, and very, very special guest with me today, my original co-host in the first 2 years of being on air radio, transitioning out of positive news, newspapers, etc., the one and only Danion Brinkley. We're going to get him started in a moment. I'm just going to remind you, first of all, Danion, saved by the light, at peace and light, secrets of the light. It's been a while since I've talked to him, so there may be more titles after that. Danion.com is his website if you're unfamiliar with Danion, which I know many of you are not. Recently, Friday the 13th, last week, April 13th, 2018, the unexpected and somewhat surprising passing of Art Bell. We're here to honor his legacy in paranormal radio and remember him. Danion was a regular on his show for many years and a good friend. So we're going to bring Danion on and catch up with him and talk about the life-changing legacy of the Art Bell radio career. Danion, welcome back.
Well, it's certainly an absolute pleasure to be back with you, Nicole.
Oh, I've missed you. I've thought about you often. How are you doing?
Come on. And me too. And thinking about in the early days, I was just reminiscing about those early days and just how far you've brought people's consciousness. It has a lot to do with, like, Art. Art was Art was in trouble. And when he had come to a place where they called it COPD, but, it, you know, if you smoke cigarettes for 40 years, mm-hmm. and it was like a trademark of his. And so that's what finally ended it. But when I talked to him about 3 weeks, Nicole, before this happened, because Art and I stayed friends, I was the first person to prove to Art Bell that people could read other people's minds. And, I mean, that was one of his shows, you know, and it was like all of a sudden a reality shifted in his consciousness that the stuff he was listening to on the radio, there were possibilities that some of that stuff could be true. And so when I was talking to him, he was in more pain. You could hear it. And as it got closer, you know, it just got to be too much for him. Yeah. Every breath was a pain. So wherever Art is today, wherever he is in that vast cosmic range of knowledge and love and divinity that exists and permeates our existence, Art knows the answers to everything that was unexplained. Of all those people he listened to and all those things that's gone on through his life and what Coast to Coast became, then Art has the privilege of knowing the answers to every one of those questions that we all sought by listening to his radio show, and he is not in pain. I mean,
I was just going to share with you, Daniel, that on Friday the 13th, the day he passed, he actually popped into my consciousness unexpectedly. And I found out later that was the day he passed. So I know that we were meant to do this tribute show today.
Yeah, he might not have. He might have popped in on that and wasn't even here. See, this is the fun part about Art. Think about it, Nicole. Art knows it all, and Art was brilliant. He was as great a radio personality as ever. I mean, his skill set and his ability to listen and to take apart and dissect the conversation, because he never believed anything. And that's what made him. He kept that moniker as he explored, and he would go with it. If you're Satan, call me. You know, I can remember that show. You know, the devil, or you. Or then he would have fundamentalists on. He'd have a bunch of fundamentalists on, Nicole, and then he would get a bunch of swamis, and he would just start and stir it up.
If you're a time traveler from the future, if you're interdimensional, I remember.
Yeah, or if you're just crazy, okay? I mean, it was so good, and he had these little perks about him. Most people, he was a pool shark. I mean, he could shoot serious pool. Okay? And he was a practical joker. And people never saw that personality, you know, that place where it was just Art Bell. And as a human being, he was wonderful. And why me? Art and I became really fast friends because I gave him a way to look at stuff people were talking about, Nicole. Just like in our early days, I would listen, but I've been dead. And I understand from a different point of view. When I look at stuff, I look at it completely different. And Art would watch me do that. And he would explore stuff and what I thought about it. You know, not that it was right or wrong. It's just what my opinion of it was as I would look at it. And he was so funny, you know, and as the years would pass, we would talk about issues and global and prophecy and, you know, the things that were unfolding. Because when Mona passed, and Mona was his soul, you know, she was that place that had changed him into who and what Coast to Coast became. Behind every great man, there's a great woman. And she was the perfect blend for him. And he was watching the changes because he had a really good mind, and he did his homework. He called his own guest. Think of parallel of someone that I'm on the phone with right now that is the same. You know, think of Nicole. If when you look at the people who felt and saw the truth and they've evolved, they've evolved in a course of action of of multiple possible realities that we as dynamic spiritual beings living in this dimensional reality, practicing being gods. This is the place where you come to practice be a god, and you have a right to form an opinion of it, even if it wasn't true. Okay, that's the freedom of this dimension, because in the other dimensional realities, based on the restrictions that apply to enter that reality, then the fact of whether it was right or wrong is not an issue. What exactly happens based on the divine law and the cursive law, whatever happens, these are the rules by which it operates by, and you don't have that fact that you can be wrong and think you're right. You know.
When did you first meet Art, or when was the first time you talked to him?
All right, so Art was going from politics. He was a good political analysis. He was really good at that, and he was transitioning into from talk radio politics, like you know, Hannity shows, and he started looking at all the issues that people that's going on around us and that no one talked about. So I think I was on Art's show. It had to be 94.
Wow.
It had to be 94, and I probably did the show four or five times a year, you know. And Art and I started the Veterans Day annual report. That was 19 years ago. I created the Twilight Brigade, and from the Twilight Brigade, Art was a veteran, you know, NAM era veteran. And so you have that commonality in that conversation. And so we started looking at what was going on in the health care of the veterans in the United States. And we made an annual report every year. Like I did the 20th one, November the 11th. And so death was big. This is the early 90s. You know, death was big. Raymond was. I guess the nations got scared, and or something was happening, because that's when death becomes an issue. Terrorism, all those things become issues in psychology, and Art explored that. So I not only had gone through it, and I was like Captain Dead in those times, and Art and I would get into conversations, and I was not radical in my belief system about the nature of the near-death experience, and I had already been through like two of them. And Art and I got to be so good of friends that by 1997, when I had to have brain surgery, and my dad was on the phone with Raymond, and they said that, you know, the surgery would get me, or I was going to die I was going to be in so much pain that no telling what I would do. And so they have to have open heart surgery and brain surgery. And Ramona and Art flew to Charleston, South Carolina. And through those critical days, he did his radio show literally, not literally from the room, but from the radio station just down the street. And that's how good of friends that we evolved into, because spirituality is not an elusive subject to me. You know, the nature of the spirituality of who we are as spiritual beings operating in this framework, it's not like I'm on some fervent mission. I mean, I know what happened and how, and he would say I was the most spiritual person he ever met, but I was still an asshole. Well, that was Art's descriptions. That was Art's descriptions of me. But
Moody is who you're referring to as Raymond, correct?
Say that again?
Dr. Raymond Moody is who you're referring to as Raymond, correct?
Yeah, Dr. Raymond Moody. What happened in the next?
I was just going to ask you. I remember he always used to say to callers when they would call in and wanting to connect with their loved ones that had passed, he always used to talk about lighting a candle and then remembering and talking about your favorite moments with them. That would be really awesome to do that today.
Well, if you want them to come back and visit you, you know, I know how much fun Art is having. And I know he's staying close. He's not going to let go. He will not let go. And this is me theorizing. It's not something I know as a fact about Raymond. But knowing Raymond and knowing those dimensional levels of consciousness, which, like, you know, Nicole, I don't think there's many people who know more about those levels, as early four or five levels, than me. I study it, so I know what Raymond's doing. And he has a 11-year-old and a 2-year-old, and he was 72. And what you were talking about was that he punched in on the chat room on the day he died. I said, well, that doesn't really mean that he was really alive.
You know, I was thinking that of all the people out there who would find a way to...
Oh, he'll do it. He'll come back. He'll do it. He'll find a way. I have a little doubt about it. I mean,
on the day of. I mean, that was weird. I don't think about Art Bell every day.
I passed at 10:30 in the morning, so you don't ever know.
When he popped in here, it was mid-afternoon.
Then he wasn't alive then.
Right.
So, you know, here's Art. But this is me understanding Art, Nicole. He knows and heard it all. You know, all that stuff that we all anticipate and stuff. And I'm not sad because I knew the pain he was in, and I know the way home. And I wasn't sad. I went to the funeral, because they wanted to keep it closed, and they blocked the media and all that stuff. But I went to the funeral, and I surveyed and looked to see how it could be of service to Aaron, you know, and anybody else that could talk to. And Whitley spoke, and then mm-hmm. I told this story about Art. When Art went through a crisis about his son, I knew about it, you know, and I knew about it intuitively, and I came to see Art and that kind of friendship because I not only could sense and knew so much more about it than anybody was saying, it was amazing to him, but it was a place where Art could settle in and understand that there is a very patterned nature of the spiritual dimensions or the ethereal dimensions or the quantum dimensions that they exist. So I would say that Art would sense, once he lifted out, he would sense and feel that range, and he would be able to slow his frequency down because he understands radios. He's a shortwave man. He built his own systems, so he would understand the dynamics of the science of the art form, where you slow your frequency down, you set a certain harmonic, and then that harmonic is how you dimensionally move, while you do certain, that's what, breath exercises and all that, and he would know that. So he would find a way. But where Art was at, where he was, is he was being a dad because he felt like he'd blown it so much in the early years about going with his other kids because it was the nature of Art to be able to communicate worldwide and to explore using shortwave radio. Ham operator. So he would understand frequency dynamics and he would understand those kinds of stuff to move. But in the early moments, and even if you are leaving a beautiful wife and someone that's been great for him and him great for her, and a couple of little kids and the comfort of where he was in his life, he would be focused on that more than he would be focused on trying to communicate with any of us. But I have no doubt that Art Bell will be heard from again.
What are your favorite memories of, well, let's say on the air, being on the air with Art?
Well, let me tell you one of my favorite memories of Art off the air.
Okay.
Okay, so I come up, he calls me and he says he wants to come up. I said, okay. So I came up and we were talking and, you know, the things that had come on, because if you knew Art Bell, you had to watch Somewhere in Time so he could look at Jane Seymour, and he loved the plot of Somewhere in Time. And if you knew Art Bell, you always had to go to that Montauk place in Michigan, okay, where it was filmed, and that was it. I mean, but... I came up and he had gotten him. I mean, we come up in the same time, the muscle cars, you know, the stuff that old guys can talk about. And he said, let's go get the mail. And he had bought him a Grand Am Trans Am, 400 horsepower, okay, 4-speed, when it was brand new. And we went and got the mail at 142 miles an hour. Okay, and that was that joy, you know, this is the relationship, is two guys growing up in the 50s and the 60s, you know, growing up in that time frame, and that was a joy. The best one on the radio, because people used to laugh, because art was about art. Art's ability to openly, consciously explore realities based on the credibility of the research he had done on the person that's on the air. This is how he was. There was no casualness about it. He was ready. And He was worried about this drought he had seen and that people were going through. And he went on the radio and he decided that he was going to try to use the power of prayer, because it had been something we had talked about you know, what were those possibilities? Because we would talk about it. He'd hear a show that he thought was important, and there was me, there was to me and another two other people that he would talk to about it. And so he decided he was going to get all of the Coast to Coast people, it was probably 15 million people that would listen to the show, so 13 million people that would listen to the show. And so Art set up prayer. He set up a prayer for rain, and it started raining the next day.
I remember.
And it rained like for 5 or 6 days, okay? That was my favorite one, because all of a sudden I was calling him Art God. But he had nowhere to go, Nicole, about the reality of the power of the nature of the combination of divine people coming together for a good reason or people coming together for a bad. That energy was there, and that energy operates there, and he had a way to see it in his own life. Well, that's a guy just maturing in the divine way and watching what he's hearing being true when he applied it. He never did it again, except when I was in such pain in that brain surgery thing in 97. Nicole, you know, that was like, oh, my God, when I blew my brain out in subdural hematomas and I was crushing. Art got people to pray for me, and I never knew this until later. I never knew this till later. But at about 2 o'clock one morning, or like 3 o'clock one morning, and when I couldn't take it anymore, the room cleared. This is in the hospital bed. The room cleared. There was no noise or any of that. And knowing that I thought I was going to die from it, the brain surgery, because you'd have to do open heart surgery and brain surgery at the same time, and there was no way I could make it through it. So Art got people to pray, and I know the moments because I could organize my life. I could get away from the pain, and I could organize my life. And that went on for like 3 or 4 hours before it all came back, the pain came back. And it was at the exact same time that Art had gone on the air, you know, and when he talked to my dad, and they, you know, I wasn't going to make it. And so he came. And then I told that story, and I didn't know that Art had done that. No, I didn't know. It was just another moment in phenomena. You know how I am about phenomena that reinforces that what I believe about how great and wonderful we all are is reinforced. And this is the things that watching Art, like where he would be right now, he would be paying attention to Aaron and the kids, and he would focus that energy surrounding them more than he would be intellectually searching for a way to get back here. But he'll be back. But I'll tell you some of the funniest ones. He had the devil call in, and I think Art kind of knew who this guy was, you know, not because he'd heard him on other shows, because Art was a lot about letting people ask questions. You know, he would do the show, and then it would be call-ins, and it'd be truckers, people out in the world working all night at Sears, and people working all night, the people of the night, and bars, you know, all across America and all across the world. And that was just Art, and the night brings that kind of comfort to explore those kinds of things. And Art saw it. He saw it as a way to put information out there that's truly out there from him being, you know, not a crank, and to see that it's out there and to make it happen.
I remember that consciousness experiment with the Joe, and it was interesting how he explored that afterwards, because he became afraid that it wasn't supposed
to. It scared the crap out of him.
I know.
It scared the crap out of him. I had to listen to it for like a week, you know, and he has to come off his high horse. He's wonderful. Now, remember, as grand a human being as you want to meet, you know, and went through some tough situations in coming up and going from just being a radio jock, swinging wax. I mean, he was he opened up a radio station with like a 10-mile radius up in Pahrump, and all he played was oldies but goodies. He programmed it, and this was where he first started out, and he had his own radio station, and he ran his radio station. And he played oldies, just where he started. And then he evolved into news because he has a smart, brilliant perspective. And then he evolved into paranormal, and he loved the night. You know, he's like a lot of us. A lot of us love the night. And then people are working. And he saw from the conversations of people calling in that some of these people were just as crazy as hell. And then some of them were brilliant, who had understood and looked at it and thought it through, and it was logical, especially first observers. Art could tell the difference between somebody who really did it happen to and who was just telling a story.
Yeah.
He was really good at it. And the other thing too, Nicole, brilliant. He could control the movement of the thought pattern of his audience with uh-huhs and two words to change the tempo and the perspective, because he knew when the person would be moving from putting out information or repeating their standard stick. No matter who you are, you know, Art could hear, and he could listen to see when it was going into a direction or changing. You know, he could just tell when it was going to get ready just to become some rhetoric.
It's amazing.
Do you know how people do, Nicole? And you, look at you. I celebrate Art Bell because he was my friend, and we became friends because I had a different viewpoint about what all the stuff. I didn't know too much about UFOs, except, you know, I wasn't a big UFO person, and he was, and I wasn't a big going to Mars. You know, I don't care about any of that, and I wasn't off on those tangents, and I had a viewpoint about how it all worked and what it looked like, and a couple of other guys. It's not just me. I mean, but this is my personal life with Art Bell, and we were friends, and he was a practical joker. So what was I going to tell you? So in the same place where Art created and brought the things that people talk about, it came out from, it's not in the Inquirer anymore. Look at it, where Art's career took him. It took him from when it was total conspiracy, extraterrestrials, interdimensional reality, Area 51, the devil. I mean, everything that people thought about, life after death, you know, quantum theoretical mechanics as applied. Like, he used to have his regular people that he would go to about stuff. Michio Kaku, he would have regular people that he would go to, Hoagland about Mars and Stanton Friedman. And Art booked his own shows, Nicole, so I'm comparing you to Art Bell. I mean, you, and take this as, you know, and I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true. I mean, I've known you since you were a little girl. And Art booked his own people. Yeah. Even when it went syndicated, when it went to 530 stations, okay, and then it was bounced, he would send it out by shortwave. So people anywhere in the world that was a ham operator could get his show. I mean, and he created that movement. Think about it. And look at where you are, Nicole. Come on, you held on to that dream, and I was there when you were dreaming it, and you held on to the dream, and look what you're doing.
You were there 20 years ago.
No, you was a little girl with two beautiful children, and you had a dream, and the world was moving from paper, and people didn't want to read. They wanted to watch and hear. You know, people do not want to read. I mean, it's a characteristic of people who are studying or a certain personality. But people have evolved.
Yeah.
They don't want to read it. They want to read it, but they want to hear it. They want to feel the story. What people haven't observed in the last 25 years, I'd say the last since 2012, but the 30 years span right in here. The evolution of consciousness, you can see it came digitally. Art foresaw all this. I mean, he was a ham operator. He was at 13. He built his own set that was communicating worldwide, and he was talking to people all over the world. But he saw that the medium of radio and how it was going to be. And so people want to participate. People want to hear that person's voice. They want to participate in it and interact in it, and this was Art's model. Well, it's you too. I remember Art is inspirational to you because look at who you are. You're pioneering a level of consciousness that through the years of with Art, be it on the radio, he saw things come true, things that he saw that people were talking about and saying, especially Hoagland, you know, Richard and Mars and what were the big UFO stuff now, okay, because, you know, those things like where Corey Good is and where and Wilcox, where David is, and looking at that part. Art would have loved this. Art would have loved it.
That's what I loved about him is the authentic journey of seeking that he seemed to be on, as opposed to, like you say, having a belief system and limited viewpoint. You know, I was riveted because he just seemed to be really just wanting to know what was real. And you heard from our new intro, that's really been my thing too, is what's really real and what's really possible. But we had a different approach, obviously. But you
had the feminine nature, and you're not, I've only seen you mad twice. And you know, oh God. But you know how I am. I just love it. You know, if it's not my fault, I just love it. But I'm proud. I mean, I'm proud, and Art would be proud. Here's what Art was doing, because Art, well, everybody, people don't pay much attention to the December 21st, 2012, and the Mayan calendar. You know that, you know, the only people who thought the end of time was coming and at the end of the Maya calendar was white people. Nobody else thought that, you know. It's just some hoodoo because the Mayan calendar counts backwards. It's cyclic. It goes backwards. So Art knew from, this is another conversation he and I had, but he had it with a couple other people. But, you know, I'm a big Maya junkie. You know how you know that. I mean, I have seen every ruin of every Mayan. I'm a pre-classic guy. But these guys had it going on, okay? So since December 21st, 2012, as we moved into the what's now called the universal period, that there would be no secrets, okay? Art knew this, so he created this little radio show, and he groomed this little girl, Heather, this little young girl, and she was carrying the weight of Art's show on her shoulder. And Art had his, he produced his little show. He ran it out of his radio station. And here's what Art was trying to get her to do in the last 3 months. In all that pain of breathing, right? I mean, he's got to put oxygen on. He's got, you know, you can't smoke cigarettes for 40 years and not have a few problems. Mm-hmm. And he wanted her to go on Area 54 and broadcast live. And he would set up the remote at the station because, you know, Groom Lake is just down the street. And she said, Art, I could get put in jail. He said, I'll come bail you out. Now, this is Art. He sees the power of women in the calendar. And if you pay attention to it, usually when a new period begins, and this is from their sacred book, the Puma Baal, and it says that the first 52 years, that's how tight they had it, or close to that, would be about the matriarchal power, the rise of the feminine. And when you hear all that, and you know, I've been studying them since the 60s, when you hear all that and then you see the rise of the feminine and the Me Too movement and Harvey Weinstein and Hillary getting to be a legitimate runner for president and the power of women in politics and the power of women in industry and now the protective value that comes with harassment of what so many women go through in life, you know, that there are predators and people who abuse that kind of power and control, okay, that shows itself too. But we're in that period of women, and he didn't want another guy. And the other thing that Art told me, he said, Daniel, new kids discover old stuff, it becomes amazing to them what I heard about and what we've talked about and what me, and he had his little his circle of friends and what we talked about. I see it unfolding. So here's Art. Art lived on the radio every night to see a transition from maybe it was a possibility or you were crazy to believe that there was extraterrestrials. So here's another fun night with Art. Am I boring? Is this boring?
Art was never boring. You have never been boring a day in your life. You mentioned earlier about getting mad, and I was
remembering that one time when he was setting up something with Kraskin. Do you remember that whole fiasco?
Oh, yeah.
What was that about?
Yeah, I went to it. We, Kraskin, he was mad about it. And Art saw that what Kraskin was going to do was to reinvent himself.
He had originally predicted there was going to be spaceships landing and everyone went out to film and broadcast live, right?
10,000 people.
Oh,
Kraskin went on the show, and he was telling this because he was coming to do a show in Vegas, you know, and to make Vegas and to play Vegas. You know, that's, you know, I mean, that was it. And maybe to get a show here, you know, to do a show. And so what he was doing was he was using, well, not hysteria, but he was using based on his program, you know, the Mentalist, that he was going to draw in extraterrestrial beings. But what he knows is in group consciousness, you know, the worst observer is a first-hand observer. You know, when you review witnesses, the person who was there, as they have the four people have three completely different views of the same event, the eyewitness, okay? Because, and so he knew that he could create people seeing things like planets moving or UFOs or spaceships, and people are going to see it, you know. People are going to buy into it, or if they had a couple of beers in them when they came. So Kat and I drove back, and we went to it, and we were supportive of it because I have seen him do, I know it's Mentalist, but I know that it's become to a point in Kraskin, it had come to a point where he and the art or the trick or he and the art had become really synonymous. I mean, he was capable of doing things at the time, not out of repetition and routine, but that he had discovered a methodology that made him more accurate. So he was going to create this as a reason for people who saw something and people who didn't. But he could reinvent himself from picking out numbers and names and phone books and pages in phone books. He could reinvent himself knowing that the extraterrestrial movement was going to, you know, there's too much noise out there about it for it not to be the next movement. So Art saw that. And
really
so Art... Well, Art wanted it to be true.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a UFO, Art can deal with a UFO better than it can deal with ghost busting. You know, his scientific mind could deal with it, so he wanted it to be true. And it was a letdown. I mean, I called Art from there, you know, and I told him exactly what it was. And I don't like to talk bad about people, Nicole, except maybe if it was Neil Donald Walsh.
yes, that was fun.
It was fun to hear you. Listen, it was just fun to hear you. It was just fun to hear you laugh.
That's how I learned how to survive on the air and manage the energy. It was an excellent training session for me.
You were brilliant. And let me ask you something. Where's this soul to soul going? Where do you go? Because Art got him on the radio, Art blistered him. When he got Kraskin on the radio.
Yeah, I remember there was some huge fallout after he really called him on it. But that's where, again, it was like an authentic quest that he was on, as opposed to just, you know, talking out. You know, there's a lot of ego on the air and a lot of superficial stuff. And he just seemed to not, like you said, he was more independent. He was more authentic.
Yeah, and Art was, Art is just as arrogant as any human being can be. I think I'm a narcissist until I got around Art. Well, but it was Art's personality, though, Nicole, and his personality was he was really smart. So he's a smart guy, and he could as a broadcaster, he could control the input of the information from the guest, because you could listen to the questions, you know, and you know which period of time through the night what questions, because I'd be on Art's show, you know, we'd do 4 hours, and you know, because it'd be different subjects, or somebody had passed, and you could look at the different viewpoints of how they would do it, and I'm authentic, and you know, I have the same, my stories are the same, and my viewpoints of certain aspects of it have evolved, but the same thing for all of the people who listened to Coast in the early 90s. I want to tell you one more really funny show. Still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, part of the big thing for the Catholic Church back in the day was that the head of the exorcist of the Catholic Church, the chief exorcist, he went on Italian radio. This is art. He went on Italian radio saying that if you believed and saw UFOs, then you were possessed by a demon and you needed to have an exorcism.
Oh, my God.
And then, wait, now it's even better. And then Art found some cross-reference to exorcisms that it is increased by 700%. There'd been a 700%. This had to be maybe turn of the century. Isn't it great that you and I can say that we had the turn of the century back in the last century? All right. And in the turn of the century, there was so much. There was Travis Walton. There was Whitley Strieber. And there were so many people. John Mack had discovered people who were, he did a brilliant paper on abduction comparison to abused children, and so many things that came about within the study of abductions that were found also seated in child abuse. This was Dr. John Mack at Harvard University. So Art was trying to get an interpreter so he could get to this exorcist to see if the 700% increase had been more people thinking they had been abducted by UFOs and going to confession. Watch how smart this is, Art. Now, and this is the way Art. This is what I think. What made me love him and appreciate him, because he's thinking it through. Okay. And so when he would start to look at it, I mean, he knew something was afoot, and it was good news. It was a story. You know, you always had to have a drama. And Art's show was dramatic. It would create drama, but it was Art's style of broadcasting. And then came the day, okay, he called me. Then came the day that the same guy went on national Italian television and said that if you saw a UFO or you were abducted by a UFO, you were no longer considered possessed. You would no longer be considered possessed, and that not only are there extraterrestrial beings, he's had the pleasure of being in contact with them, and the church is looking forward to teaching them about Jesus Christ. That's like a 10-year period, though, Nicole.
Yeah.
This is an evolution of something over a 10-year period that Art drove. A lot of the things about UFOs and interdimensional realities and all of that stuff, and quantum and CERN, all that stuff, Art had a chance to witness the evolution of it and hearing about it from scientists, because everybody in the world would go on Art Bell's show, because not only Art had called them, even with Premiere, Art booked his own. He booked his own people. So think about watching that, being aware of it, 700% increase, and now how much is out there that 11 countries have reduced their UFO information, and Buzz Aldrich, he passed a lie detector test based on his belief and proof that he had seen alien spacecraft. And then one of the guys took a lie detector test about an encounter with a being. You know, he was describing it like an angel, but having an encounter with a being in the bin of the space shuttle. So where are you going to go?
What other groundbreaking moments did Art Bell create on his radio legacy?
Oh, man, he brought near-death experience to mainstream. He brought the whole UFO, Area 51, Roswell spacecraft, and cults. I mean, the fact that there are secret societies, quote-unquote, and that they operate using certain esoteric or ethereal laws that operate, and that they are aware of them. Some of them are subtle, like easy spell casting. Some of those are subtle. And then some of those collectively equal to rain, that Art himself showed the massive power of the consciousness of the people in of the night on Coast to Coast Radio, that they could channel and make a difference. And that scared Art. He never did it again, Nicole.
I know.
He never did it again. And if it was me and you, think about it, when you were bending spoons and you were putting people to practice to put this together, because without adding that to the show, like a 4-minute segment for us to focus on something, you know, or a 3-minute segment or a slight small guided imagery that we collectively direct our attentions and focus, you know, you have a show and you go through the points, get the guest, have that show back and forth, and then at the end to take the knowledge and information and formulate it into a focused 1-minute attention span, and you condition your audience to do that. And I pushed Art hard, you know, and then after 97, when I found out this, it was like 3 weeks before I knew that Art had done it. No, it's like 2 weeks before I knew I had done it, because I wasn't interested in what anybody was thinking or what those conversations were, because the kind of pain I was dealing with and that grand mal seizure that I had before the surgery, that's all I could think about then. But once I have no problems about when Art turned to the people of the night and turned them to help me. You know, that helped me. I not only was aware of it, I could see it, and I know what I used it for. So take each show at the end of the show, and I was trying to evolve him to this with Heather, the little girl is trying to fill Art's shoes. Glad it's not you.
You know, that's one question I have, is that there's got to be somewhere where someone's archived all of this amazing radio. Is there somewhere that you know of where people can access the archives of Art Bell?
Yeah, they're doing it now. I mean, I think it comes off of George Norrie. I think it comes off of Coast to Coast, because it was always his Somewhere in Time. And all shows in the transition place from Art to George, I mean, there was a lot of, like, unstableness.
Yeah.
You know, Art, you know, it was time. But Art didn't want to quit, and you can't quit. It's like you. You love what you do because you're bringing hearts together, bringing minds together, empowering people. I remember all of those little things that as you were growing and going through what you were doing, that you were really putting out as a part of trying to prove. Okay, mm-hmm. Here's another one of the best ones, Art all time. It was one about reverse speech.
Yeah.
Okay, and Art was cooking with this reverse speech because he could play it back and forth. He had a studio with everything in the world, communications worldwide, built at his home in Pahrump. So he could communicate worldwide, digitally, anyway, as the equipment evolved. He built his own radio station. This is the Art, the mind, and the solderer. He built his own radio station. You know, he built the tower, the transmitters. He did all of that. And so when it got to reverse speech, he loved it. I told him that I was on Nicole Whitney. I said, Art, I was on Nicole Whitney, and they weren't going to do reverse speech. And I said, we did reverse speech on me, and it was all the thing it was about was sex.
I remember that.
Remember that? And he said, Danion, you're talking about sex the whole time. See,
oh
the
God.
Joy of that, Nicole. But watch, listening to you laugh. I can take a celebration of Art Bell, and I get a chance to talk to you, and watching that you are the same. I mean, you have that kind of drive to create and make the world a better place, and everybody who listens or who doesn't listen, everybody who listens should tell at least 3 other people who don't listen to listen, because, you know, I was there from the very beginning. Damn, I'm old, Nicole.
And you're also doing the same thing, relieving the fear around death for people and doing the hospice work. How's that going?
The toilet, Well, the Twilight Brigade, you know, became one of the largest end-of-life care volunteer programs in the history of America. I've been in the same offices in the West Los Angeles VA, the largest hospital in the VA system, for 21 years. I've been a hospice volunteer with an office in the VA for 21 years, and the Twilight Brigade is considered equal or superior, and the training is equal or superior to anything that our Veterans Administration has, and it's been recognized as that. You know, I've been an Oprah Outstanding Charity. I mean, you know, and I grew complementary and alternative integrative therapies quietly within the system. It's changing now. I mean, I'm changing the Twilight Brigade's mission. Now is the time, based on the boxes of knowledge, you know, look, we have military on the border in Mexico, and on the border of Mexico, and we have Salvadorians and Hondurans crossing the border, okay? Well, if you read Chapter 5 in Saved by the Light, I said it just exactly like that. This is what the probable possibilities of the predictions of the future, okay, and these are the things that would come about. Art was big into that stuff, you know, because he could run it by me. I wrote it down in 1976. But you know what, Nicole, I never thought that stuff. I always remember I used to laugh and call that Nostradanian. Well, because it was just a part in my life that I never saw it as prophecy. I don't see it as prophecy now. What I see it as is that the ethereal or the dimensional spiritual world sees the probable possibilities, like nothing was carved in stone. And Daniel, these are the markers. Those were the milestones that I would watch for. And when certain things happen, I would shift course. So I'm shifting course of the nature of the Twilight Brigade. I am shifting its course, not because I want to or not, but because the time frame of the events that are going to occur in the next couple of years, especially the 2020-2021, then these are going to be dramatic changes. The structure of the economic system, the fact that the world will stop, you know,